we're gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting October 27th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for October 27th, 1889, famed anarchist general Nestor Makhno is born in Ukraine. He would lead the anarchist black army against the Bolshevik Revolution. From the song dedicated to his life, quote, "Our flag's black in the wind, black for our sorrow, red for our blood," unquote.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, October 27th, in 1919, Edmund Goldman, a well-known anarchist and political activist, appeared before federal immigration authorities at Ellis Island to speak out about her deportation order. Goldman had just been released from prison after serving 2 years for opposing the U.S. military draft during World War I. During her hearing, she expressed the irony of a government that waged wars in the name of democracy while it suppressed free speech and criminalized peaceful resistance. Instead, she felt, quote, "Free expression of the hopes and aspirations of people is the greatest and only safety in sane society," unquote. I can get down with that, but I would add that people's free expression of their hopes for their government will also keep us in check. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on October 27th, 1920, in an attempt to get all the radicals out of Philadelphia textile mills, 40,000 workers are fired en masse. Also on the state in 1932, Bing Crosby would record "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" The recording would enjoy considerable popularity in a year when few Americans could afford to buy records. This downbeat song reflected the plight of World War I veterans, thousands of whom decamped in Washington, D.C. this year. These past veterans, known as the Bonus Marchers, were brutally routed via tanks, sabers, and tear gas one night by forces commanded by then Army Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur, showing once again how disposable veterans are to the government and how much respect they have for them once they are all done up serving their needs. Also on October 27, 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee calls its first witness to Hollywood loyalty hearings and a grand demonstration of what freedom is really all about in America. Lastly, on October 27, 1990, Muslims, Jehovah's Witness materials, propaganda, and satanic books are burned in Dayton, Ohio by a religious right mob. This Week in Radical History for October 28, 1902, in Kansas, working woman, universalist, feminist, and anarchist writer Kate Austin dies. Also on October 28, 1929, stock exchange collapse, Black Friday, starting the Great Depression and world economic crisis. Deja vu all over again. Also on this date in 1965, Pope John VI formally absolves the Jews of collective guilt for the crucifixion of Jesus. Today, I, Pope Michael, do not absolve the Catholic Church of all its historic barbarism in the name of its gods. So mote it be. Today in 1997, a doctor in New York is one of the long string of people injured as a bullet is shot into his home by an anti-abortionist. Most of such assassination attempts are fueled by right-wing hate groups and all in the name of their God. While using religiously fundamentalist ideology, they borrow from groups such as the KKK and Heritage Foundation. Today, six Minneapolis residents are facing terrorism charges for the crime of organizing the protests against the RNC last month. Meanwhile, VP candidate Palin would argue that abortion provider assassins are not terrorists in her small, hate-filled, God-loving mind. This Week in Radical History for October 29, 1901, Leon Czolgosz, anarchist, electrocuted for the assassination of U.S. President McKinley. His last words were, "I killed the president because he's an enemy of the people, the good working people, and I am not sorry for the crime."
People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 29th in 1929, Black Tuesday, also known as the Wall Street Crash of 1929, occurred, devastating the stock market and causing widespread economic panic throughout America. Although there is debate about whether the crash of 29 was a result of the Great Depression or a cause, it is definitely agreed that it was one of the most devastating stock market crashes in American history. The quick drop in stock prices caused bankruptcies and severe financial difficulties for businesses, The result was mass unemployment and quickly deteriorating living conditions for the American working class, which happens to be a majority of the American population. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
50 years later, 1979, up against the wall, direct action disrupts New York Stock Exchange and the financial district in New York. There'd be over 1,000 arrests. Lastly, for October 29, 1966, the National Organization of Women is founded in Washington, D.C. This week in radical history, for October 30, 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. is arrested and jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, on charges stemming from a demonstration 4 years previous. Quote, "I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' councils, nor the Ku Klux Klanners, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice." Martin Luther King. Also on October 30th, at the height of tension over World War II coming, the nation, and especially upstate New Yorkers, start to panic at this broadcast, which you're about to hear part of, which was broadcast live, uninterrupted, 70 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity in downtown New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that joins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain is conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Ah, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. Those creatures know what that means. What anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. Some shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Oh, the heavy caught up by the woods of fires. There's gas tanks for the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. We continue now with our piano interlude.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill, their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be, the Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
Small segment from Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, broadcasted 70 years ago on this date.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 30th, in 1973, the Pacifica radio station WBAI aired a monologue called Filthy Words, done by the comedian George Carlin. In his routine, Carlin listed and made fun of the seven dirty words, words which cannot now be uttered over public airwaves. Apparently, a complaint was filed with the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC. Although this was the only complaint filed, it eventually landed the Pacifica Foundation in a Supreme Court case against the FCC. The final ruling was in favor of the FCC, and it established many restrictions on the content of publicly broadcast material. Although these indecency rules apply to all American media outlets, the penalties and fines are much more damaging to community radio stations such as the Pacifica stations, who aren't funded by corporate advertising. How unfortunate. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for October 31st, 1517. Apropos of Halloween, Protestant Reformation begins as Martin Luther King nails his 95 theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg. Also on October 31st, humanist anthropologist Joseph Campbell, 83, is now a myth himself, on this date in 1987. This week in Radical History for November 2nd, I only got three items, 1920. Imprisoned anti-war and labor activist Eugene Debs receives over 1 million votes for president. Imagine how he would have done if he was actually outside of jail when he ran for president. Also on this date in 1972, 500 Native American protests, the Trail of Broken Tears, as Native Americans marched to occupy the Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Washington, D.C. for 6 days. Also sadly, in 2006, the University of Oaxaca is attacked in the AM with tear gas and shots reported on campus. Radio APO is at the center of this month's long struggle inside the university, still broadcasting. Earlier this week, indie media reporter Brad Will was gunned down by state militia in Oaxaca barricades, covering the atrocities of the Mexican government against the people of Oaxaca. Thanks for tuning in to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Glee Glee Studios. Normally this segment runs about 20 minutes long, so today on the third anniversary week of Brad Will's death, I'll be playing a portion of the kind of memorial segment I produced on my weekly indie media radio program from 2 years ago about Brad Will and his life and death. So this segment will run from now to about the 20-minute mark this week. So until next week when we meet again, I am forever yours and always in the struggle, Mike Cannon. And again, Brad Will, presente. Normally in the beginning of my show, this is the Mike Cannon Show, Indie Media Radio for Central Wisconsin, by the way, I try to keep it light, keep it a little fun before we go into the news, the non-corporate news I feature on my show each week. However, this week is a little different. This week is the one-year anniversary of the indie media reporter, anarchist, and activist death, Brad Will. I knew Brad only slightly as one of the many interesting newer comrades active in trying to make a positive change in this world. However, his death affected me and many in our community pretty dramatically. It demonstrated to us firsthand how draconian the forces we fight, or at least try to shine a light on, can be. Brad was unique, but his death, sadly, was not unique. From Brad Will's death in Mexico last year to Rachel Connie's death earlier at the hands of Israeli occupation forces as she tried to stop a U.S.-made bulldozer from illegally demolishing a Palestinian doctor's home, to what we now know as what's happening in Darfur, to the 1 million-plus Iraqis who have died since the start of the war, many innocent people so rudely just get snuffed out and forgotten as the rest of the world pays little or no heed to their plight. In this country in particular, where six major corporations own something like 90% of the media the average American gets spoon-fed to them each week, of course these unflattering images and stories are not going to be told. Don't draw back that curtain, and certainly don't look in the mirror, America. So instead of my normal fun-loving self, I dedicate this first part of my show to Brad Will on the anniversary of his death, with an edited rebroadcast of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman did last year. I took out a little of the struggles about Oaxaca, Mexico, that Brad Will was covering when the Mexican forces assassinated him last year. Not because it's not an important issue, because like so many of the times before, we know the answer to the story. It is a story that happens when the powerless confront the powerful who have guns. And after Brad Will's death last year, paramilitary forces, not unlike paramilitary forces in Colombia, are working with the multinational companies in Nigeria right now. They managed to kidnap or outright kill enough people to put down any chance of self-government, self-rule, or even just a little bit of dignity for that matter. So it is an old story played out time and time again in Politic Royale. So today I concentrate more on Brad Will's story. On today's show, you'll hear a lot about Brad Will's life and all his struggles and activism. I just want to let you know that Brad Will spent a lot of time in southwest Wisconsin in his younger days, and I believe his folks brought his body back to Wisconsin for interment. Again, here is the edited version of Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Broadcast, where you get to hear a little bit about Brad's life and his struggles and his causes. Lest we forget, Brad Will presente.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife and children, but I've many friends. And some of them are with me. An old woman gave us shelter, kept us hidden in the garret. Then the soldiers came. She died without a whisper.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Brad Will!
Presente!
Emilio Alfonso Fabian!
Presente!
Mourners gather outside the Mexican consulate in New York to pay tribute to journalist and activist Brad Will. He was shot dead in Oaxaca, Mexico, Friday. He died with his camera in his hands. We'll go to Oaxaca, where thousands of federal police have been deployed to crush the popular uprising. And we'll remember Brad Will with those who knew him best.
Brad was just completely full of heart and courage. He was a big risk taker. He always did the riskiest part of any action. But unlike a lot of people who are intense that way, he did it out of love, not out of ideology.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Mexican city of Oaxaca, thousands of federal police, backed with armored vehicles and helicopters, have raided the southern city in an attempt to crush the popular uprising in the region. Federal police have reportedly seized control of the city square. At least two protesters died last night, including a 15-year-old boy. On Friday, gunmen with ties to the government shot and killed three other people, including the U.S. journalist and activist Brad Will. Five men connected to Will's shooting have been turned over to state authorities. The suspected gunmen have been identified as two members of local city hall, two police officers, and the former justice of the peace of a nearby town. Brad Will was filming on his video camera when he was shot in the stomach. The sound of the shooting was captured on his camera. Brad Will died as he was being taken to the hospital. He was 36 years old. The break today is Brad Will singing.
Esperanza.
Gaza. طفلة تنتطي قوسا.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We are all aware of the Zionist campaign throughout the country to pressure colleges and universities to sanction professors who dare to teach any courses that study the colonization of Palestine by Israel. The professors, their courses, and all who support their academic freedom to teach are labeled anti-Semitic. This campaign is endemic across the country. Well-funded by pro-Zionist organizations and individuals who aim to silence anyone who dares to take up the Palestinian narrative. Such a campaign has hit Tufts University. Its target, Professor Tom Aboud, who teaches a course called Colonizing Palestine. Professor Aboud is a scholar and author who wrote the book Colonial Jerusalem, The Spatial Construction of Identity and Difference in the City of Myth, 1948 to 2012. Tufts University is trying to terminate a five-year contract with Professor Aboud after its first year, yielding to pressure from the same old Zionist pressure groups and wealthy alumni. This presents a serious academic freedom issue, similar to hundreds of others across the United States. We hope to have Tom Aboud back on This Week in Palestine in the near future to talk about the all-too-familiar smear campaign now being waged at Tufts University. But this morning I want to read a letter from California Scholars for Academic Freedom that was sent to Tufts University President Anthony Monaco that lays out the serious threat to academic freedom that this assault represents. And I'm now quoting from the letter. Dear President Monaco, California Scholars for Academic Freedom, a group of over 200 scholars who defend academic freedom, the right of shared governance, and the First Amendment rights of faculty and students in the academy and beyond, wish to express our serious concern at the threat to the full renewal of Professor Thomas Aboud's contract at Tufts University. A professor in Tufts' American Studies and Colonialism Studies program for the last 2 years, Professor Aboud has taught in the Anthropology and Arabic Culture programs over the last 7 years. In June 2018, he was promoted to a senior, non-tenured position, a promotion based on a review of his record of teaching, publication, and service to the university and to its students. A promotion to that rank normally comes with the expectation of several years of security of employment at any institution with which we are familiar. In President Aboud's case, his contract language apparently stipulates a five-year renewal unless his performance proved not satisfactory. Professor Aboud's contributions to the institution and the profession have, by Tufts' own assessment, proven to be highly satisfactory. It therefore comes as some surprise to us to learn that Professor Aboud's position may not be renewed beyond the coming year. Whatever other justifications may be invoked for this unexpected curtailing of his contract, we are especially troubled by the evident correlation between this threat to Professor Aboud's security of employment and the scurrilous attacks that have been aimed at his course, colonizing Palestine. In a manner that has become all too familiar to us, as an organization committed to the protection of academic freedom, this course has been targeted by small external pressure groups that pretend to represent large communities, such as the Horowitz Freedom Center, the AMCHA Initiative, or Stand With Us, but which lack either legitimacy or intellectual integrity. The sole purpose for which they exist is to suppress freedom of expression in relation to Palestine and Israel, and to prevent any teaching or other form of public engagement that represents fairly and in depth the Palestinian view of the conflict, a view that students at university like Tufts, with its honorable traditions of engagement with public affairs, surely need to be exposed to. In order to achieve their aims, such pressure groups resort not to reasoned argument, but to innuendo, defamation, and caricature. Their public statements about the course that we have reviewed are utterly familiar to us, revealing a litany of ignorance, shrill accusations, and complete unfamiliarity with the rich intellectual and cultural traditions of Palestine, and in particular with the authors and artists that Professor Aboud presents to his students. Unquote. That was a portion of a letter sent to Tufts University President Anthony Monaco from California Scholars for Academic Freedom, sent in support of Professor Tom Aboud. This Week in Palestine will continue to follow this story in the weeks ahead. But now on to our feature presentation this week, which is a speech given by Ahmed Abuzneid at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., where he addresses the intersectionality of the Palestinian Liberation Movement with Black Lives Matter. Once again, we have a presentation that includes visuals that you will be unable to see, but the rich narrative allows its use for a radio audience. It begins with this introduction.
Today we are joined by Palestinian attorney and activist Ahmed Abuzneid. As a co-founder of Dream Defenders, Abuzneid has a history of activism and has demonstrated his passion for social justice. Dream Defenders is an activist group formed in response to the murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida. Through Dream Defenders, he has focused on the issues of mass incarceration and police brutality, particularly against Black Americans.
And in 2015, Ahmed led activist delegations from the Movement for Black Lives to Palestine in order to highlight the intersectionality between the Black Lives Matter movement in America and the Palestinian struggle. Currently, he works as the director of the National Network for Arab American Communities, which is a consortium of 26 independent Arab American community-based organizations with a mission to represent the needs of the Arab American community at the local and national levels.
So, good evening. I'm using my phone here. It's a product of just, you know, I think, how do I say, habit. You know, the phone is in my hand 24/7, and also I'm saving trees by not printing out a speech. So the second one I just thought of before I came up here, so it wasn't really part of the strategy, but thank you for joining us. You know, it's a Friday evening. You could be doing a lot of things, and I don't doubt that those things could be very important and valuable uses of your time, but I consider this to be also a valuable use of your time. How to start? Well, I want to show a video. It's a video that we put together after our first delegation, or actually while we were in Palestine, and then I'll begin the talk with a little bit about the historic connection between these liberation struggles. You know, when we begin to examine the connection between the Black liberation struggle and the Palestinian liberation struggle, we have to go, to the past. And the first example that I want to lift up for us to examine today is Malcolm X. And, you know, when we talk about intersectionality, I think I heard intersectionality mentioned earlier. You know, Malcolm was a leader at the intersections of black liberation and Muslim liberation in this country, you know, fighting for the rights of both of those communities, and really was, I think, one of those characters that just continues to shift the way we think about our sacrifice, the way we think about our limits, and the way we think about the power that we can develop as a community. And so Malcolm X had a chance on his trip to the Middle East. And by the way, I don't like that term, the Middle East, either. It's just easier to utilize in this short form talk. Malcolm X, upon visiting the Middle East, had a chance to go to Gaza. And he met a poet in Gaza that left an imprint on him. And it was during his time in Gaza that he began to make the connections between U.S. imperialism and Israeli imperialism, or the colonization of Palestine, as is the colonization of this land here. And so always important to note that we are here on stolen land. Malcolm began to see these parallels during his trip to Gaza and Egypt, and he wrote a piece in the Egyptian Gazette, September 17, 1964, titled Zionist Logic. And it's a short essay, maybe a page and a half. I won't read it all to you. I do want to read an excerpt, and you can go back, you know, through Google on your way home, or not while driving, of course, and check out the full statement. But I do want to read a bit of an excerpt from it. And this was in 1964. So, you know, I'm going to talk about another shift in the conversation in 1967, but this was in 1964. And I quote, "Did the Zionists have the legal or moral right to invite Arab Palestine, uproot its Arab citizens from their homes, and seize all Arab property for themselves just based on the religious claim that their forefathers lived there thousands of years ago? Only 1,000 years ago, the Moors lived in Spain. Would this give the Moors of today the legal and moral right to invade the Iberian Peninsula, drive out its Spanish citizens, and set up a new Moroccan nation? Where Spain used to be, as the European Zionists have done to our Arab brothers and sisters in Palestine. In short, the Zionist argument to justify Israel's present occupation of Arab Palestine has no intelligent or legal basis in history, not even in their own religion. Where is their Messiah?" Now, I won't get into the religious debate on this subject. That's for other people to have. You know, I tend to examine this subject strictly from a human rights perspective. While I understand the religious nuance to it, you know, I think some things are clearer than we make them to be. And so I choose to look at them in that lens. So why did Malcolm X take this stand? About that time, Malcolm X was beginning to shift from a black nationalist stance to more of a pan-Africanist stance. And at that time, he also was seeing the connections between Gamal Abdel Nasser and Egypt, and this relationship between pan-Arabists and pan-Africanists. And it was important to him to lift up this subject because even though today we see Palestine as a litmus test, it was viewed as such, you know, way back in the day by others. And so Malcolm lifted up this controversy so that black Americans and those of conscience in the United States can begin to look at Zionism within a different lens. Because previous to this, in 1948, you know, many in radical leftists and communist circles even were in support of the Israeli nation state. They viewed it as essentially a fight against imperialism. Because imperialism at that time was only maybe viewed for through the arms or tentacles of the U.S., the U.K., the French, you know, some of those nations that, you know, traditionally had been involved in colonization, whereas Israel was a new form of colonization. And so 1948, you know, many people didn't really fully absorb the subject of what was happening. The facts on the ground weren't made clear to people. The population demographics, the shifting in land, none of that was clear to people. And so for many people, 1948... Zionist was a liberation movement. This began to be clarified for folks in 1967, and so there was a shift after the 1967 war, where Israel was essentially clarifying its colonial intentions and its colonial state for the world to see. And one such example of that shift is SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Many of you who have studied the U.S. Civil Rights Movement have heard about SNCC. Freedom Summer, registering folks to vote in black communities, risking their lives, and really yielding to a representation of liberation for all, and that's what led them to issue a statement on Palestine when they were examining, you know, third world struggles, as they put it, when they were examining internationalist struggles, as they put it. And so they released a statement on Palestine in 1967. What's important to note is, you know, regarding SNCC, is that they faced significant backlash for this stance on Palestine. And that's not different than what we see today for organizations that are willing to take the stance for Palestinian liberation. In the June-July 1967 SNCC newsletter, shortly after the 1967 war, they wrote a piece titled Third World Roundup, The Palestine Problem, Test Your Knowledge. And it was written by Ethel Miner. Ethel Miner was one of the SNCC leaders most responsible for pursuing the issue of Palestine and educating folks around the issue of Palestine. She was communications director at the time, and her primary source was a pamphlet published by the Palestine Research Center called Do You Know? 20 Basic Facts About the Palestine Problem. And it basically went through, you know, some really key facts around the displacement of the Palestinian population, the subjugation of the Palestinian people, the massacres that were committed. So it made clear to folks from SNCC what the Palestinian problem really was, and, you know, the problem wasn't the Palestinians. So after its release, though, as I said, there was some controversy. John Williams, who was then administrator of SNCC's national office, called a press conference to announce that the article did not represent SNCC's official position. And soon thereafter, staffers in Atlanta called for a press conference to announce the release of that statement. Another point of fallout is that Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, in his many talks, he's referred to the essential evaporation or the dismantlement of SNCC based on their position on Palestine. And so as he put it in one of his speeches, immediately after the statement, phone calls rang in and the checks stopped coming. And cars that were being utilized to get people registered to vote had to be returned back. And so funding was being pulled away immediately due to SNCC's stance on Palestine. Furthermore, SNCC released a more formal statement in response on August 15, 1967, entitled The Middle East Crisis. It incorporated many of the points that were previously mentioned in the earlier piece, the unofficial piece. But within it, it also added context that acknowledged the horrors of the Holocaust, the suppression of American Jewish voices that protested Zionism, and the critical support given to Zionism by the United States. Of course, all these subjects are not to be ignored when discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but it showed that, you know, in order to present the subject, they had to take more of a politically correct, even-handed approach to at least getting us to the subject. And I think we see many of those dynamics still present today. Another example I want to highlight is the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party never shied away from their politics. They were exclusively Marxist-Leninist. They were exclusively internationalist, and they never wavered on that. Now, their stance on Palestine was always strong. They did, however, at one point, ask for Israel to respect the 1967 borders, and I think that was at the request of the PLO and Fatah. So they still maintained the consistency of being connected to the Palestinians that they were working with at the time. But the first Black Panther Party statement in 1970 proclaimed, "We support the Palestinian struggle, just struggle for liberation 100%. We will go on doing this, and we would like for all the progressive people of the world to join in our ranks in order to make a world in which all people can live." You know, once again, the Black Panther Party had a very internationalist lens of looking at these things, and they viewed these struggles as part of a connection between working class peoples, between third world peoples, and those of us who lived within empire, and that can't be overstated. The Panthers made a point to mention that they were in daily contact with the PLO, provocatively, obviously. I mean, it may be more acceptable these days to be in conversations with PLO, but in those days it certainly was not. They also had a deep relationship with the PLO via their participation in the Algiers Conference. There was an international section of the party, and so the Black Panther Party then decided to open up a branch in Algiers, in Algeria. The statement was made at a press conference in 1970, and it was republished in 1972 as a part of To Die for the People, the writings of Huey P. Newton. Kwame Ture, who I described earlier, was a member of SNCC and the Black Panther Party. He described Palestine as the tip of Africa. And I think, you know, this is something that for me became clear upon visiting the Afro-Palestinian community in East Jerusalem for the first time. Because if you go to the old city of East Jerusalem, you'll see Ali Jeddah usually sitting on the steps heading down into the old city. Ali was referenced by Aja, in the poem. He calls himself the Denzel Washington of Palestine. He is one of our national treasures for sure. Not Denzel, but Ali. you notice that as soon as you enter the Afro-Palestinian community, there's a big image at the entrance, which has Africa, and the northeast tip of Africa is Al-Aqsa Mosque, or the Dome of the Rock, I'm sorry. Stokely's designation of Palestine as, the tip of Africa, I think holds true for many. And we don't shy away from that connection. But Stokely once remarked that he had two dreams. I dream, number one, of having coffee with my wife in South Africa, and number two, of having mint tea in Palestine. And for those of you who've had mint tea before, it tastes better in Palestine. So make sure you experience that one day. So what does this solidarity look like now? I'm thankful to say, and I'm proud to say, I'm happy to say that we have a bit of a rejuvenation of that movement in the last few years. It takes work. And, you know, as I said earlier, we acknowledge that we didn't come up with this stance of solidarity. We didn't create this connection between the Black and Palestinian struggle. We're merely continuing the work of those who, you know, have led the way before us. But also important to note here that, you know, solidarity is not philanthropy. Solidarity is not missionary work. Solidarity is really driven by a realization within oneself that your struggle is connected to the struggle of another, that the system you're fighting against is connected to the system of oppression of another, and the realization that we need to abolish these systems in order for us to get free. So once again, solidarity is key not only to liberation for Palestinians, for Black Americans here, for Native Americans here, for families being ripped away at the border. We have to have solidarity for all of these and acknowledge that these systems have to fall. So how did we get to this point of this latest iteration? The Dream Defenders was founded in 2012 after the murder of Trayvon Martin. How many people in this room have heard of Trayvon? Raise your hand. Wonderful. That's really great to know. Sometimes you'd be shocked that some people haven't heard the tragedy. So the Dream Defenders was founded in 2012. We founded the organization by launching a march from Daytona Beach, from Bethune-Cookman College. Bethune-Cookman University, a historically Black college and university in Daytona Beach, Florida, and we marched 40 miles to Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon was murdered. Now, this was the first founding event, the first organized event for the Dream Defenders. Previous to that, we had a couple of phone calls to essentially organize for this. And on that first march, I had a T-shirt that had Palestine on the front and a picture of the Dome of the Rock, and I had a keffiyeh, a red and white keffiyeh, the whole trip. So, I mean, I wasn't intentionally trying to interject Palestine in an issue. What I was doing was representing, you know, what brought me to this fight. What I was representing was what made social justice and human rights so important for me as a person. And it was a great conversation starter. So in this 40-mile march where you're marching for 3 days, spending nights on church floors, spending nights on community floors, you have a lot of deep conversations. And in those conversations, we began to make a lot of connections between the struggle of the Palestinian community back in Palestine and the diaspora and the Black community. I was not shocked to find out that many of the folks on the march had already known. So this wasn't, again, new to many people. It was something that maybe folks needed a little bit more nuance and a little bit more education around, but they understood that something was going on there. And so, you know, that was the start of the Dream Defenders. But, you know, why would a Florida organization that was founded in the aftermath of a murder of a young Black male that is committed to ending the zero tolerance policies in the state of Florida, why would an organization like that, take a stance on Palestine and be so concerned with Palestine? Well, first and foremost, I'm one of the founders of the organization, so we were going to speak up on Palestine. We were not going to remain silent on an issue that, for many of us is life and death. But beyond that, you know, beyond the theoretical connection or the personal connection to the issue, we began to examine the issue within the United States of racial profiling, you know, policing in black and brown communities, and, of course, mass incarceration. And we know that the United States imprisons more people than any other country in the world. We know that the United States profits off of the imprisonment of black and brown bodies, mostly black bodies in this country. And so when we looked at that, we then found out that U.S. police forces were being trained in Israel. And it's not that U.S. police forces needed to be trained in Israel to learn how to be racist or to how to be anti-black or how to kill unarmed people. But they were able to collaborate, right, with another settler colonial state in its infringement on the rights of indigenous and minority communities. And so we should pay attention to this. What we also found out is many of the same actors that were involved in imprisoning Palestinians were also involved in imprisoning Americans here. And in fact, in Florida, one of the violators of these rights is G4S. G4S had been active in the Palestinian territories and actually, I think as of last year, had announced, due to pressure from BDS and this internationalist movement, had announced that it was pulling out of Israel. However, yes, absolutely, that's something to celebrate. However, they're not gone from Florida and they're not gone from the United States. And in Florida, we had youth detention centers and youth detention facilities facilitated by G4S. At that point in 2013, 2014, about 85 to 90% of the juvenile prisons in Florida were privatized. So when we think about zero tolerance policies that Dream Defenders were fighting against, and we think about these private prison profiteers that Dream Defenders were fighting against, and we thought about the fact that police were being trained to enhance their skills to quell protests and to, you know, staunch any type of dissent in this country, you know, we had to make those connections. And so beginning in 2014, we began to examine the possibility of a delegation. We started to think, you know, 2014, you know, Movement for Black Lives now had started to penetrate, you know, the country, had started to penetrate college campuses. So we knew someone from Movement for Black Lives needed to be there, or several folks from Movement for Black Lives. There was the New York City Justice League that was ramping up in protest due to the death of Eric Garner, or the murder, I should say, of Eric Garner. Raise your hand if you've seen Eric Garner. You've heard of Eric Garner? Absolutely. So we knew there were connections that were existing across the country with freedom fighters that we wanted to be connected to the Palestinian struggle. And we planned for this delegation, and it was going to be in July of 2014. Can anyone remember what happened in July of 2014? War. The war, okay. So the assault on Gaza, one of the latest assaults on Gaza. It was really a dark time for many Palestinians and those who, you know, care about the Palestinian struggle, or for those who, you know, have warm blood flowing through their bodies. There was so many dead children at that point in 2014 that they had to store some of the children in ice cream freezers. There was no more room in the morgues. One of the fallouts from this war for us as Dream Defenders was that we would no longer be able to have our delegation in that time. Actually, it was for August. I'm sorry, it was August. It was scheduled to be August 10th, 2014. But with this war and this onslaught and this death and destruction, we decided we had to hold off on our delegation. And, you know, it was the right decision. And although at that moment I felt really powerless and I felt really weakened by what was going down and also our inability to connect to it and do something about it, things work in mysterious ways, and sometimes they end up as they should. And so what happened a couple of weeks later in the beginning of August, could someone tell me what happened in the United States in August 2014? Mike Brown was murdered in Ferguson. Another unarmed black male lost his life at the hands of those who were sworn to serve and protect him. And we began to see, you know, the community in Ferguson and St. Louis rise up. And it's wonderful to see folks from Ferguson in the building tonight, because I think, you know, just like many of us draw inspiration from the Palestinian struggle and Palestinian resistance, we felt similarly with Ferguson. And so in Ferguson, you had community beginning to rise up. And what you would notice after some time was that you would see the Palestinian flag being held down at some of the rallies and protests. And the reason that this happened is because while people in Ferguson were being, you know, essentially in conflict with a military, the U.S., you know, the U.S. police forces, which were becoming more militarized at that moment, they were being shot at with tear gas. And Palestinians were not only tweeting their support and essentially, you know, advocating for their resistance, but they were also tweeting about, you know, how to resist the tear gas and ways to essentially combat the tear gas. What are the things you should do with, you know, what should you wash your eyes out with? Which direction should you run in? And so Palestinians from Gaza and the West Bank were making these connections with folks in Ferguson. And so it was no shock that you began to see these Palestinian flags being waved in the streets of Ferguson by non-Palestinians and sometimes by Palestinians, of course. So our trip got delayed. Mike Brown gets murdered. This resistance movement ends up developing in Ferguson. And since our trip was put off, we then were fortunate enough to be able to add folks from Ferguson. So you noticed Tara Thompson and Tef Poe, two of the folks in that video, helped to, you know, found out Hands Up United in Ferguson, where they do breakfast and book clubs, essentially, very similar to what the Black Panther Party did, you know, making sure to give nourishment to the people in addition to educational nourishment. And so January 2015, we embark on this journey, and it was a really special moment. So since then, Dream Defenders has done two more delegations, and I've also led one for Interfaith Peace Builders, also known as Eyewitness Palestine. But this will still be the most special delegation, you know, and I have no problem saying that, because I think just the timing, the organic nature of the relationships, and the connections between the people that were on this trip to this day were really special. So I want to show another video now, and I'm not sure if this thing is messed up. It is? Cool. Thanks, Muhammad. So, you know, after the delegation, we began to work with several groups across the U.S., you know, to push this message of solidarity, to push the experience of the delegates. And we got a chance to work with Angela Davis, with Noor Arakat, with folks from the IMEU, several of the folks who really are leaders in this work. And they created this video, which we can't hear right now.
Every 28 hours, a black life is stolen by police or vigilantes in the...
When I see them, I see us.
Every 28 hours, a black life is stolen by police or vigilantes in the U.S.
Every 2 hours, a Palestinian child was killed in Israel's attack on Gaza last summer.
Eric Garner, 43 years old, father of six, grandfather, friend.
Ghalia Al-Ghannam, 7 years old, killed when an Israeli missile struck her home.
Hashem Abu Maria, 45 years old, father of four, human rights worker.
Ayanna Jones, 7 years old, killed in her sleep by Detroit police.
When I see them, I see us. Harassed, beaten, tortured, dehumanized.
Stopped and frisked, searched at checkpoints.
Administrative detention, youth incarceration.
When I see them, I see us.
From Rikers Island to Ophir Prison.
From Rafat to Chicago. Lives are being stolen.
Remember them.
We are not statistics. We are not collateral damage. We have names and faces.
Sakia.
Nadim.
Kimani.
Jawahir.
Renisha.
Muhammad.
They burned me alive in Jerusalem.
They gunned me down in Chicago.
They shot our water tanks in Hebron. They cut off our water in Detroit.
They demolished our homes in the Nakba.
They swallowed our homes in New Orleans.
When I see them, I see us.
They see our wombs as dangerous, label us demographic threats. They sterilize us without our knowledge, mark our children as criminal.
We say no to all forms of oppression, in U.S. cities or on Palestine streets.
We respect the uniqueness of our struggles and our varied histories.
When I see them, I see us.
We'll be right back.
resilient, steadfast, determined, I see who we were meant to be.
Alive, free, liberated.
Mapping out our destiny.
I see hope.
Strength.
Love.
A place where our children can dream.
I see a road. A partner.
A family.
A world where we can rise and be seen.
So, it feels so funny. So a couple people that I noticed in the video that I just want to shout out because they've been so important to this work. Christian Davis Bailey, who helped to found Black for Palestine. Also Aja Monet, who was on that first delegation. And again, I'm stressing the importance of this first delegation. Aja went on to not only produce several pieces of poetry centered around Palestine, but in August 2017, she and I led a delegation together where we brought together artists and organizers to experience Palestine and develop projects together. I'm sure, you know, I've missed a couple names. You all saw some of the individuals. Some of them need no introduction. But it's really powerful to see that, you know, what we've been imagining and dreaming of here, people have been receptive to. So next up, I'd like to talk about, you know, as I said, Dream Defenders had done a couple more delegations, and Dream Defenders is one of the organizations within the Movement for Black Lives had a central position to this topic and this conversation, you know, to educating folks within the Movement for Black Lives around this subject and the nuances therein. And this came to a head in the summer of 2016 when the Movement for Black Lives released their visionary policy platform. Anyone here read that document? Can you raise your hands if you did? Okay. So really dynamic, visionary document listing out demands and solutions for Black America, listing out demands and solutions that would help many of us as marginalized communities in the United States. And so there was stuff around education, just really very nuanced document. But the part that got the most reaction and pushback was the one paragraph around Palestine. So I want to read that to you all because it's important in the context of the conversation around SNCC and their stance to understand what happened to the Movement for Black Lives after 2016. So the paragraph reads, "The U.S. justifies and advances the global war on terror via its alliance with Israel and is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. The U.S. requires Israel to use 75% of all the military aid it receives to buy U.S.-made arms. Consequently, every year billions of dollars are funneled from U.S. taxpayers to hundreds of arms corporations who then wage lobbying campaigns pushing for even more military aid. The results of this policy are twofold. It not only diverts much-needed funding from domestic education and social programs, but it makes U.S. citizens complicit in the abuses committed by the Israeli government. Israel is an apartheid state with over 50 laws on the books that sanction discrimination against the Palestinian people. Palestinian homes and land are routinely bulldozed to make way for illegal Israeli settlements." Important to note in this moment that we've seen this same thing within the last few weeks and the introduction of the Israeli nation state bill. So this issue is clearly not going away. "Israeli soldiers also regularly arrest and detain Palestinians as young as 4 years old without due process. Every day, Palestinians are forced to walk through military checkpoints along the U.S.-funded apartheid wall." Since that visionary statement, again, you know, Black folks were asking for things like reparations, and that did not get as much pushback as the paragraph around Palestine. It's important to recognize. The consequences were loss in networking opportunities for many of these organizations. They lost relationships, especially with funders, and actually lost funding. So many groups lost funding from different foundations in the U.S. because of their relationship to this platform. There were also a loss of different opportunities and events that were canceled because of this stance. Because I have to wrap up soon, I'll just go through one last quick example. So in 2017, Aja Monet, who I was just speaking of, was able to co-organize a delegation with me to take some folks from here to Palestine, and one of them was Vic Mensa, a recording artist with Roc Nation. If you went to the Jay-Z 444 tour, he was opening for Jay-Z. Really dynamic young individual. And I just have one excerpt from his piece, which was titled, "What Palestine Taught Me About American Racism." "The parallels between the Black American experience and the Palestinian experience are overwhelming. Staring into the worm-infested water tank on top of a dilapidated house in Aida refugee camp, I can't help but think of Flint, Michigan, and the rust-colored lead-poisoned water that flows through their faucets. As I gaze over the 25-foot, quote-unquote, separation wall, the economic disparity is acutely transparent. The Israeli side of the wall looks like the Capitol in the Hunger Games, while the Palestinian side reads like a snapshot from a war photographer. It's as if the south side of Chicago's most forgotten and disenfranchised neighborhoods were separated from the luxury of downtown's Gold Coast by a simple concrete wall. The sight alone is emotional, and many people in the group cried on that roof. Rage cannot describe how I feel thinking of the insects swimming in that water tank, while just across the wall is an Israeli settlement with an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So I just want to lift up again the work of Black for Palestine, the Dream Defenders, the folks at Standing Rock who have been in solidarity, many other folks that are taking the stance with us in these days in trying times. And I want to, before I leave, just shout out the BDS movement, which is a way for us to nonviolently isolate Israel until it comes into compliance with human rights. As you can see, it's effective because they're trying to make it illegal for you to involve yourself in a nonviolent action here. And so I just want to lift up BDS as a model for us to take part in, for us to share at our local levels, and for us to hopefully win on. So thank you very much. I'll take time for questions.
So thanks for that wonderful presentation. I had a question about some of the challenges in the Black-Palestinian relationship. Mm-hmm. I do know there has been conversations about the way, for example, Ethiopian Jews in the, Israel and Palestine feel that the relationship has soured between them and Palestinians. And also, I know that, so I recently had a chance to go to Palestine mm-hmm. With a delegation with the Center for Constitutional Rights and with Eyewitness Palestine. And we had a conversation with actually Jamil Dakwar, who was saying that it is true that there are some Palestinians who use the term slave as sort of a slang term when referring to Black people. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the challenges I wanted to just raise as well, and I wanted to hear your reaction and how people have tried to organize or respond to those types of challenges.
Sure. So first I'll address the issue of anti-Blackness via use of the word Abid or Abid or any other of the treatments associated with anti-Blackness from Palestinians. I think this is both born of historic relationship between Arabs involved in the slave trade. This is where obviously the term Abid or Abid comes from, so that's important to note, you know, that we didn't learn to be anti-Black from someone else. We had anti-Blackness in our culture for centuries. And that is obviously still prevalent and in some parts of the Arab world still existent, right? And so that's important to acknowledge. You know, but there's also a part of Western anti-Blackness that's at play here that gets exported out. And you find that not just with Arab communities, but with communities from the Caribbean, with communities in Africa. Many of us that are immigrants to this country are told, above all costs, stay away from the Black people. And it's because I think the U.S. has been very successful in exporting that image of Black Americans to the point where, you know, I once had a cousin in Jordan, and I think I shared this story with you, who was asking me why my Black American friends didn't look more like Soulja Boy. And for those of you who don't know, he's not a very well-known rapper, but this is what they thought, you know, Black folks would look like. And at first I was really shocked because I was like, why didn't she ask me about Tupac instead of Soulja Boy? Like, how does she even know who Soulja Boy is? He's not that popular. But I guess at that point in time he was. And so how are we responding to those challenges? Well, actually, there's also another nuance to that subject. When Arab Americans come here, a lot of times we open up stores in primarily Black neighborhoods, right? And the relationship sometimes between the Arabs who are owning these stores and the Black community is toxic. Toxic because they come here with that mindset sometimes where it's anti-Black and it doesn't allow for a relationship to develop. And so then they view Black Americans in these communities as vehicles for them to transform themselves financially as opposed to people within a community they'd like to build with. So what are we doing to challenge that? Well, we're having conversations. And I think for many Arabs in the room and for Palestinians in the room, we know that that starts at our dinner room tables. It starts at our iftar dinners during Ramadan. It starts on our trips back to Palestine, where our folks simply just do not understand the nuances of Black Americans in the U.S. And they also don't understand how hurtful that word abid or abid is to all of us. So that's, you know, one of the things we're doing is conversation, but also in promoting this solidarity, we're able to have a two-way road of education. And so when we go there, not only are we learning from Palestinians, but Palestinians are learning from their black counterparts and their native counterparts and their Latino counterparts. So, you know, we have to do a better job of education both ways. To the point around the Ethiopian soldiers, you know, that's a very, I think, tense relationship because similarly to how you come to this country and you have to make sure you're the furthest thing away from black Americans in order to assimilate into white supremacy and to these power structures. In Israel, the easiest way you can gain power and stature and status within that society is to be anti-Palestinian. So for these Ethiopians, they have to serve in the military and they have to be the most staunch supporters of this Zionism in order to gain their acceptance. And so there have been conversations, I think, with Ethiopians. And I think what we're hoping for as Palestinians is to see more Ethiopians refuse military service. But also maybe within that conversation, we need to figure out how we can better support Ethiopians. And I know there have been protests in 1948 Palestine or Israel where Palestinians have joined in hand in protests with some of these Ethiopian Israelis. But that's a conversation we need to continue. And by the way, that rejection of military service is something that we're asking of Jews of all colors and races within Israel, and some of them are doing it and accomplishing it, so that's really inspiring.
You have been listening to a presentation by Palestinian activist Ahmed Abu Znaid speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome back to PCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Series of letter bombs sent to Trump's former opponents in the United States this week. Does that make any sense, like, at all? Yes, we look at this week's dubious terror outrage in the United States, then some real right-wing terrorism in Brazil, as Jair Bolsonaro, who harkens back to the good old days of Brazil's fascist dictators, looks to be elected president on Sunday. First, he'll relax the gun laws, and then he aims to dismantle the Brazilian state, because he said it's inherently less corrupt than the private sector. And when he gets in, the champagne corks will be popping at Southcom. Who are they? Well, they're the Americans that control Brazil now. Just a branch of the Pentagon. Also, what is the INF Treaty on Land-Based Nuclear Forces, and why is Trump pulling out of it? More importantly, what does it mean for us here in Europe if the Trump regime decides to send the special forces in to instigate regime change in Moscow, like they did in Iraq and Libya? This Cold War INF agreement saw thousands of missiles with ranges between 300 and 3,400 miles range destroyed, and all further developments of them banned. And an international criminal court lawyer from The Hague says he believes they'd rather poison defendants to death there than allow them to be acquitted. What kind of justice is that at the International Criminal Court? He also explains who really runs it. Us Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, some of the ones the mass media have turned a blind eye to. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, the Bristol Eugenics Clinic. Something horrible going on down at Bristol Keys Assessment Centre at Temple Keys, run by private DWP contractor Contact Associates Limited. Don't you just love it when able-bodied professionals pick on disabled people and others who aren't able to fight back? Disabled Bristolian Fran Mayer updates us on how the local branch of the Department for Work and Pensions are getting on stripping her of her benefits to which she's legally entitled. Their fiendishly simple method is to refuse to test her for disabilities, which means she gets her benefits. Also, Marco Verhey will give us some history of the Bilderberg meetings at the Bilderberg Hotel itself, recorded over in Arnhem last month, that interview. Plus, former top Canadian civil servant Elizabeth Woodworth on her definitive 9/11 conspiracy report. It's called 9/11 Unmasked. You can listen to Dialect here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Right now. But Martin, I think we should start with this story, which is breaking news that apparently the perpetrator has been found over in the US of these various letter bomb attacks.
Well, we'll have to wait and see whether he is the perpetrator or whether this is all smoke and mirrors.
It's amazing that none of these letter bombs actually went off, isn't it? It's quite lucky.
Well, it is, but it looks to me as if they were designed not to go off. I mean, people who were making letter bombs generally make them to go off, and these ones that didn't have batteries in, some of them, I've seen the photographs, didn't go through the mail because they haven't been franked. The stamps haven't been franked. So we've got to suspect here, as many on the right do suspect in the US, that this is some kind of put-up job by the deep state. But, of course, that's possible because the deep state in the US is very powerful and they do all sorts of nasty stuff. And this is relatively minor compared to the stuff they usually do.
So, I mean, you're saying that some of these bombs were possibly not actually viable?
Well, then none of them were viable because none of them have exploded, have they? And in actual fact, it looks as
if... Surely that's because the FBI have come along and made sure...
We don't know, is all I will say. The suspicion that somebody in the intelligence services have set this up, or some political force has done it in order to try and influence the midterm elections, is quite possible. But the question is who and what's the motivation? What are they trying to do? So, for example, it could be that they're trying to show Trump's opponents as being persecuted, and therefore, and they've leaped forward and said, oh, Trump's to blame for this because he's encouraged this kind of thing. But, of course, it could well be that people who want Trump to succeed who've done this, because it makes people who say these silly things look bad if it turns out that in actual fact it was a pro-Democrat person, for example, who'd sent these things to try and make Trump look bad. And we're in the world of psychological war games, and nothing should be taken for granted.
Well, there's been an arrest in Florida. Apparently, these were posted or came from originally from Miami, Florida.
Well, if they've got somebody and they put them on trial and put it in front of a jury, then we will decide possibly what has happened here. But we don't know for sure. We're not sure who's behind it or what the political motivation is. It's clearly a political motivation. The question is what? And, of course, I'd like to remind people of the anthrax attacks following the 9/11 incident, if I can call it that, in which six people died. That was definitely carried out from inside the US because all the anthrax came from Fort Metrick in Maryland, which is the US equivalent of Portland Down. But nobody has ever been convicted of that, even though it's absolutely clear that somebody inside the US intelligence structure must have been responsible for killing those people. I think that's pertinent to bring that up at this moment when we're all supposed to be running around with our hair on fire about this.
Well, the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by the Murdochs, is saying that it's Cesar Sayoc, 56 years old, he's in custody. Two packages were found on Friday addressed to Senator Cory Booker and to James Clapper. So he's the guy who's been arrested, and all that much known about him. Online court records show he was arrested in Miami back in 2002 for another bomb threat. He received 1 year probation for the incident, according to the records. He has two other criminal cases in the Miami courts, the records show.
Well, it may well be that the police have just gone to find him because he's already got a record of sending bombs, and it may be that he's nothing to do with it at all. I'm just saying.
Well, let's have a listen anyway to the BBC breaking news coverage on 5 Live of this incident, where they went directly to the CNN headquarters in New York when the these bomb threats were first heard of. And we hear from their reporter, who starts this piece from 5 Live, by the name of Jennifer Smith.
The US Secret Service has said that a suspected explosive device was sent to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. A US official told the Associated Press that a functional explosive device was found at the Clintons' home. Officials do say that they proactively detonated the device and determined that it did in fact contain explosive powder and had the components of a bomb. And they were discovered by technicians who screen the mail that gets sent to these former US officials like the Clintons and the Obamas. But this is also 2 days after a bomb was found at the home of a liberal philanthropist and financier, George Soros, in the suburbs of New York City. This was confirmed to be a pipe bomb, which was discovered in a mailbox at his house. And he has become a frequent target for criticism and by right-wing groups due to his support for liberal causes.
OK, all right, that's what we know as far as we can go at the moment. Jennifer, thank you. Jennifer Smith reporting there.
We can speak, though, to Phil Unger, who runs the Flute Centre of New York, which is right opposite the Time Warner Centre. Phil, thank you very much for speaking to us. What can you see? What's been going on?
Well, I'm looking at my window right now. By the way, the Time Warner Center is not actually downtown. It's Midtown.
Right.
And there's, I'd say, a few hundred people outside the building. We watched the building be evacuated and people poured out. But it seems to be more of a non-event than anything else. There's a few camera crews out interviewing some people on the sidewalk. But people seem to be going about their business as they do in New York. There's not much that shocks us here anymore. And so it seems to be a day as any other day in New York City.
Well, as thankfully nobody has been injured in this series of bomb attacks, whatever it is, we will have to wait to see what who the police claim has done it and what their motivation is, because it could be that there are people who hate Trump's critics, or it could be that this guy is a Trumpist and he's it could be that he's a Trumpist and he's attacking Trump's critics, or it could turn out that he's a liberal Democrat and he's trying to make Trump look bad by sending bombs to people, which, especially bombs that don't go off, to liberal politicians and figures, to so that Trump then has to defend his own rhetoric.
Well, look, I mean,
but I definitely think there's some game going on, for sure.
So when Jennifer Smith talks about the Secret Service telling her and Associated Press, I mean, the Secret Service, is that the CIA? Who exactly is
Well, exactly. So in other words, we're just being told, somebody told me this, and
someone told Associated Press.
Yeah,
I'm reading out what it says.
And in actual fact, the Secret Service are potentially suspects in a case like this, which is why, of course, you need an independent civilian police force to look into it.
Why are they suspects?
Because they are trying to influence the political debate in the US.
Do they ever give things which might be potentially bombs to people in order to set them up?
They've done this loads of times with loads of people in the US. People have been approached and said, psst, 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 do you want to blow something up? Psst, psst, do you want to blow something up? And then people eventually, often people with drug, alcohol or mental health issues, are then eventually persuaded to blow something up.
I think it was maybe Ryan Gallagher at The Intercept that put a brilliant article a few years ago saying almost every terrorist attack in the United States had actually been set up by the FBI.
I think it's 100%, Tony, since 9/11.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put a link up 100%. To that on our show page.
All supposed terrorist attacks in the US.
I'll just thisweek.org.uk.
US Intelligence Services.
So, also, they're saying it's a functional explosive device, and that they actually did try detonating it, and it had some explosive powder in it. So, what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us what they're telling us they want us to hear.
Bomb components in it, too.
Yes, okay, but if you're going to...
None of that actually means that it's a bomb, does it?
No, it doesn't, and it may well be that we're being told a load of fibs anyway. Don't presume that just because it's an official source that it means it's true information. Doesn't necessarily mean that at all.
What about this Soros angle?
Well, Soros is quite unpopular on the right wing in the US because he supports liberal causes that they don't like. So therefore, it could be that a right winger has sent him a bomb. But it could also be the FBI, CIA, deep state pro-Democrats who are sending him a bomb to make him look as if he's a victim so that Trump looks bad. So in other words, you can't presume that you know what's happening when some incident like this occurs.
So what about
you've got to ask the question, qui bono, who benefits?
Right, what about the strategy of tension, because this sort of thing, it does smack to me. I'm looking at the UK Times map here. We've got 8 different apparent bomb attacks, but none of them actually went off. Now this gets everyone panicking, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, the strategy
of tension. What's the point?
The strategy of tension, as you know, is the name for what went on in Italy during the 1970s and 1980s, where it was definitely NATO intelligence services, and they weren't sending fake bombs, they were planting real bombs, like at Bologna Railway Station, that killed 86 people. And the idea that the intelligence services might be orchestrating this in order to create fear and so on, and so that they can have more power. Don't forget that all of the anthrax letters, which killed 6 people in the end, were sent to liberal Democrats who might have voted against the Patriot Act, so-called, which then brought in all of this kind of repressive legislation. And because they've been sent these anthrax...
We've got the midterm elections coming up.
It's clearly related to the midterm elections. Whoever's done it, it's either a lone wolf, either a conservative or liberal who's acting on their own, or it's the deep state. One or the other, or possibly both. Because, of course, if the deep state are operating, they will then dump it on somebody. This guy may be the guy they're going to dump it on. Do you follow me? It doesn't mean he's done it. It just means he's the one who's going to go to court for it.
OK, the last... also, we've got the Khashoggi case with... I think it was Sky reporting yesterday that body parts of Khashoggi have been found. This guy who it looks like was murdered in the consulate in Istanbul, a Saudi journalist working for the US newspaper, The Washington Post. But anyway, let's have a listen now to some more questions. I mean, a lot of questions being asked about Saudi Arabia because of this. And this was one at Prime Minister's Questions from the leader of the SNP in the House of Commons. Who is Martin?
It's a difficult one. Is it Robert Jeff? I think GR is in my mind.
His name begins with an I. Ian.
I've forgotten it.
Ian Blackford, anyway. I'm not saying that the SNP are inconsequential. It's just difficult to remember their names sometimes.
Ian Blackford!
Well, I'm afraid the Prime Minister said nothing about arms sales. Condemnation won't do. It's action which is required.
Absolutely.
Mr. Speaker, the Saudi Arabia regime is responsible for multiple human rights violations. Critics face death by crucifixion, teenagers tortured, women imprisoned for campaigning for their human rights, the brutal bombardment of Yemen, pushing that country to the brink of famine, and now the state-sponsored murder of Jamal Khashoggi. What more evidence of criminality does the Prime Minister need before she fully commits to ending the sales of arms to the brutal regime in Saudi Arabia?
Prime Minister!
Say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, we are concerned about the humanitarian issues in the Yemen, that we are actually the third largest humanitarian donor to the Yemen, and our support has provided significant support to millions of men, women and children in the Yemen. I might remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that, yes, we do support the Saudi-led coalition military intervention in Yemen. That has been recognised by the United Nations Security Council, and it came at the request of the legitimate President Hadi. Now, in relation to defence exports, the procedures we follow are among the strictest in the world. They were introduced in the year 2000 by the late Robin Cook. They were updated in 2014 by the Conservative-led coalition government to reflect our obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty. And a licence will not be issued to Saudi Arabia or any other destination if to do so would be inconsistent with any provision of the consolidated EU and national arms export licensing criteria. And in July 2017, the High Court ruled that our sales to Saudi Arabia were compliant with those regulations. But of course, we keep these under review.
Well, I mean, that's just basically boilerplate, isn't it?
Well, look, hang on a minute. I mean, she's saying that it was a legitimate intervention there with the legitimate president saying, inviting the Saudis in.
No, no, let's put it, inviting the Saudis in. When are the elections in Saudi Arabia? Is the Saudi regime at all legitimate? It's recognised as international.
What she's talking about is elections in Yemen. Now, President Hadi, who was elected, invited the Saudis in.
Yeah, but he was the only candidate in that election and nobody else was allowed to stand and loads of other people weren't happy with it. What you've got in Yemen is a multi-sided internal conflict between different political forces in Yemen. There's no case whatsoever for outsiders to intervene in Yemen.
Isn't it really a proxy war being waged by the West on Yemen that the Saudis are fronting?
I think the Saudis have got their own reasons for trying to keep the Yemenis under control, because they're a much more populous state than Saudi Arabia, and if things were to rights, then the Yemenis would probably have access to all of the oil money that the Saudi royal family has stolen. But of course it's also part of a geopolitical game against Iran and ultimately against Russia and China. And so the poor Yemenis are being, you know, unfortunately for them, are in a strategic position, and the powers that be want to tell them what to do.
Okay, let's move on to take a look at Brazil now. Big election, big country, one of the BRICS nations too, Martin, on Sunday.
Yep. I mean, as you said earlier, the opinion polls, the latest I've seen, suggest that Bolsonaro will probably win. But that is just going to be the beginning of a very rollercoaster ride for Brazil and for everybody else, actually, because Brazil's such an important country.
What happened to Lula? I thought he was quite
popular. Lula's in prison on trumped-up charges of corruption on the basis that he was bribed with a holiday flat, which he never went to, which seems pretty absurd. But because he's in prison on this trumped-up charge, he couldn't stand in the election. And the opinion polls put him ahead of Bolsonaro, so if he'd been allowed to stand in the election, he might well have won. But of course, the Americans and their allies, the CIA, the people we were talking about earlier, have made sure that he can't stand, so that Bolsonaro gets a free run to run the country. And of course, Bolsonaro's...
Surely the Brazilian people understand that the Americans have been involved in this whole judicial coup process and...
Well, they may do, but the fact
they
is...
They won't vote for him?
Yeah, well, yeah, but
they're voting for an American-appointed president.
Well, the Bolsonaro coalition is made up of all sorts of different ragbag of elements. And of course, once he comes to power, he'll have to run the country, and he'll be running it very much on behalf of the multinationals. And of course, there's going to be an economic crisis. So it's not at all clear that he's going to be able to stay there for very long, because there's going to be a political or social explosion.
Surely the way it works is if you have some sort of crazy far-right leader, that the people like the IMF start to play ball and they try and make things easier. So it feels better with him in charge.
No, because what they want is to get rid of all the social progress that was made during the Partido dos Trabalhadores era, the PT, Lula, Dilma Rousseff era. Bolsonaro will basically dismantle all of that, and that, of course, made a huge difference to poor Brazilians.
What happened to Dilma Rousseff?
Well, she's still out of jail, but she's also barred from standing because they're both supposedly corrupt. In other words, the two most popular left-wing politicians in the country have been ruled out of order by the Supreme Court, working closely with the Americans, and therefore the far right get a free run at the presidency. It's pretty disgusting if you think about it.
How important is Brazil? Because there's other countries nearby which there's also quite a lot of turmoil, like Venezuela.
Well, the
Colombia.
Whole of Latin America, the what they call the pink wave of the 1990s, where left-wing governments finally came to power after decades of right-wing repression in Latin America, and did a pretty good job, it has to be said. Ordinary people had their living standards improved. There was a definite change in the atmosphere. In Brazil, for example, they had this family allowance, which went to the poorest mothers, which helped them to feed their kids. All of those things were built up. But of course, it's all dependent on that wretched thing called international capitalism. And when international capitalism decides that's the end of that, that's the end of that. And so all of those social gains are in the process of being smashed. But of course, the population aren't necessarily going to remain completely passive in the face of all of this.
Well, Southcom, what's their role? Because they're based in Florida, but they seem to have quite a large role in South America these days. They say most of it is just humanitarian.
Well, it's just, I mean, SOUTHCOM is the means by which the US military controls Latin America. And, of course, they're talking about invading Venezuela, possibly. Trump's openly talked about it. Colombia is being talked about as being, they're already pretty integrated into NATO, but becoming part of NATO. And, of course, if there was any invasion of Venezuela, it would come from Colombia and possibly also from Brazil. I understand the Brazilian army had been moved to the border with Venezuela in anticipation of Bolsonaro winning on Sunday. And we could then see a joint invasion of Venezuela by Colombia and Brazil, backed by the United States. But, of course, the Venezuelan army may very well resist, in which case we're going to have another crisis to deal with in Latin America, which is actually an interstate war.
Things hotting up, too, between the United States and Russia, particularly this week with President Trump pulling out of this INF treaty, Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Just to recap, it is a treaty which bans weapons, ballistic missiles with ranges of, all sorts of missiles, actually, ground-based missiles, between 300 and 3,400 miles in range, and developments of these have been banned. Now, the Americans have said that the Russians have violated the treaty, so there's no point in being it anymore.
Well, the reason why the Americans say that, because that kind of range of missile is no use for the Russians to shoot at the United States, which is 10,000 miles away. So the only way that those missiles based, if they exist in Russia, can only be fired towards Europe, basically. But, of course, from the Russian point of view, there's a basic geographical imbalance here, because the Americans are right in their face, and if they can fire short-range missiles at them, they'll be able to hit Russia in a matter
Martin,
of a minute.
Jens Stoltenberg has said the Russian violations of the 1987 nuclear treaty with the US meant it was no longer effective. And so he's speaking ahead of these major Trident Juncture NATO exercises in Norway and Scandinavia. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke for the first time since Trump said he was withdrawing from the INF treaty. He said the US was complying with the arms control treaty. The problem was Russia. The treaty could not be effective if only one side was respecting it. The treaty was signed in 1987, he said. So we don't have an effective INF treaty due to the violation by Russia, says Stoltenberg.
Well, the Russians deny that. They say that we have, and it's you're the ones who are ripping the treaty up. But, of course, let's put it this way. If you rip the treaty up, then the Russians will be perfectly within their rights to develop such missiles. They've actually developed much more powerful missiles which can whack the United States from Russia directly in a matter of minutes. That's what they've decided to do.
If
you're going to push them to the point where they've got to be on a hair trigger, then when they're on a hair trigger, they will go all out straight away.
OK, Stoltenberg was speaking ahead of these largest NATO exercises in decades. Trident Juncture is being held in Norway with 50,000 personnel from 31 countries, including Finland and Sweden, in land and sea manoeuvres around the Baltic. About 100,000 vehicles, 150 aircraft involved, based around the defence of the Nordic state against an imagined attack. So is there likely to be any kind of attack against Norway?
No, there isn't. But, of course, from the Russian point of view, this is potentially an attack on them. But they're quite level-headed about it. If there is any attack on the Russians, they've got pretty good conventional defences. And if it goes nuclear, as Putin said in Valdai last week, we will nuke you. Don't imagine for 1 minute that if you go nuclear that we're not going to go nuclear. We are. And, of course, they've just had the biggest exercises ever in Russia, but they were held in the Far East with the Chinese participating so that it wouldn't cause any provocation to the West. But nevertheless, they're quite prepared to defend themselves. If we want to waste money...
That could be provocative to places like Vietnam or South Korea.
Well, I mean, is anybody allowed to... If we're going to have a situation where there are no rules and anybody can have any exercises they like and we're all just going to make random threats... The point about these treaties, which were agreed in the past, the anti-ballistic missile treaty was ripped up by George W. Bush, which meant that we're back on the situation of trying to do first strikes, yeah? because that's what it means. If you've got anti-ballistic missiles, you can do a first strike and then you can hope that you might escape the second strike because you decapitated the other side. They were abolished for that reason. And then the whole treaty was ripped up and we're back to where we were. In actual fact, this is a more dangerous situation now than in the run-up to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1963.
I noticed this week, very interesting article you sent me from Zero Hedge, which apparently is fake news, but don't believe what you're told by CNN and the likes of them. The Russians are saying that the Americans attack them with drones using a coordination from an aerial command plane. So this is US Air Force controlling a load of drones which attacked a Russian airbase. Now, that's an act of war, surely.
It is, and of course...
what the Russians are saying is
correct.
You
can't call this... The fact is that the Russian Defense Ministry have issued a statement saying that this took place. It's been reported on Zero Hedge, but it's not been reported on the BBC, and of course you could just say, well, the Russian Defense Ministry are making it up. But what I think, they must have known almost immediately that this American AWACS was responsible for the attack, but they haven't said anything about it because they're trying to keep it mum and try and talk to the Americans in private, like, don't do that, that's really upsetting. But now, of course, they've decided to come out with it and say, well, in actual fact, that attack on our airbase, that was run by you. It wasn't jihadis at all. That ran it.
Just focus on this for a minute. The Russians say a US Navy spy plane, this is Business Insider, led a drone swarm to attack its base in Syria. Well, I mean, the Russians, maybe the Americans would argue, shouldn't be there, and we don't really want them to be there, so we're going to attack them. And this was done apparently from a Boeing PA-8 Poseidon, which looks like a sort of, basically, it's a sort of thing that would arrive at Bristol Airport. It may be a 737 or whatever. But this apparently can control a load of drones and do an attack if it wants to. Russian defense official said a January drone swarm attack, that's this year, on the Russian military base was commanded from this US Navy P-8A Poseidon. A swarm of 13 drones on January the 5th and 6th targeted Himemim Air Base and Tartus Naval Facility, but Russia repelled the attacks, it said at the time. The US's P-8 can communicate with drones, but Russia provided no evidence to back its claims. The US Navy tried to attack and kill its servicemen in a thwarted strike. The Russian Defense Minister, Deputy Defense Minister Alexander Formin, said a January drone swarm was actually an American attack on the Russian air base. Now, this base in Tartus, I mean, maybe we could look upon something like Lakenheath here in Britain as an equivalent. What would we be doing if the Russians had used drones to attack Lakenheath Air Base in Norfolk?
Well, we'd already be at war with Russia. The fact is that the Russians have been kept very quiet about this for several months, and they're bringing it out now because the situation is getting more and more tense, and it's about time they brought this one out to bash the West over the head with. Now, they may be lying about it, but I don't think they are, because it was a very sophisticated attack, supposedly by jihadis who'd managed to get the technology on the internet, but in actual fact it's actually a direct attack
on the Russians by the Americans. There were three goals: uncovering the Russian air defence system in Syria, carrying out radio electronic reconnaissance, and inflicting actual harm to servicemen in Syria. So one of the things it seems that this attack achieved is that it allows the Americans to see how you react to an attack. So in other words, which missile silos open up, which gun emplacements open up. You know, for example, it might be that one pops up from something which is hardened cover, and up it pops and it starts to try and attack the drones. Yeah. And also, they can listen electronically. How electronically are they dealing with these drones coming towards them to kill them?
Yeah, that's right. So in other words, whoever was in charge on the western side decided to take the risk of a direct attack on a Russian airbase. Now, what if the Russians had done a similar thing to Akrotiri airbase in Cyprus, for example, where nobody in Cyprus actually wants the British to be there? Do you remember they fought a war against us in 1950 to kick us out? But we stayed, and we've got our base there, even though nobody in Cyprus wants it to be there. What if the Russians were to just whack it with a missile? Would that be okay? Since there are no rules anymore and we're all withdrawing from treaties, we just have to say, oh, well,
the question I asked at the top of the hour, what does it mean for us here in Europe as the Trump regime, the Pentagon, etc., start falling out with Russia in bigger and bigger scale?
What they want to do is they want to get the European Union or Union states to pay for a massive military build-up, which will keep the shareholders of Lockheed Martin and, of course, BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce in beer money. That's what it's about. And, of course, the Russians are very well aware that's what it's about. And, of course, it ties Western Europe in, or ties Europe into the American imperial system. Logically, Europe ought to be developing constructive relationships with Russia, with whom we are neighbours. But the Americans don't want that, even though they live 10,000 miles away, and they're causing all of these problems and difficulties to make sure that we can't do that. Well, that's what it's all about.
What we're discussing here may become a criminal offence in Denmark, Martin. The Danish lawmakers are proposing 12 years in prison for any pro-Russia, inverted commas, opinion. Danish lawmakers want to control opinions expressed by the public on foreign affairs, and imagined by journalists too, with a new law, which could entail criminal liability for expressing opinions similar to those of Moscow.
Well, it's where we're going. It's if we do go to war with Russia, no doubt anybody who criticises the war will immediately be accused of being a Russian agent. And therefore, that's a pretty clear signal that that's exactly where we're going to end up. And of course, the Russians don't want a war. No rational person wants a war, but we could easily end up with one because you get everything onto a hair trigger and then suddenly crash, crash, bang, bang, wallop, we're there. It's only because the Russians showed restraint. What they could have done when those drones were attacking their airbase is just whacked Akrotiri, for example, or sunk a US warship. That would have been perfectly justifiable under international law, and then the balloon would be up, no matter what anybody wanted.
So what about this Danish law? I mean, that sounds as if it's not really Western liberal values there. I think maybe the Russians have got a point here, you find yourself in jail.
Well, indeed. And
up to 12 years.
Well, the whole point is that they're trying to make this idea of expressing opinions which might be construed as being in favour of a foreign power as treason. And we've seen it loads of times in history, this kind of game. The warmongers want to basically disempower those who are critical of their policy. But do you know what I think will happen? Anybody who's attempted to be prosecuted under this will have a very strong defence in international law against punishment which might be inflicted on them.
But actually, international law isn't worth a fig nowadays, is it?
All right, well, if we're going to go to a situation where international law isn't worth a fig, then maybe the Russians are going to decide to whack Akrotiri Air Base, because there's no rules. I imagine there's several hundred RAF personnel there. Maybe the only language the British understand, the Americans understand, is we've got to kill your soldiers like you kill our soldiers. And if you think we're going to give up first, you're deluded.
20 more Palestinian civilians injured by Israel's racist army this week. That story was on Press TV. Didn't hear it here on our news. But at the same time, Human Rights Watch, an American group, has condemned the Palestinian Authority for its human rights violations and using torture, allegedly, to crush dissent in Gaza.
Well, I mean, nobody is completely spotless in this situation, but I don't think the situation where you've got trained snipers shooting teenagers and children through the head at hundreds of yards range could in any way be justified as responsible as a legitimate use of force.
What Human Rights Watch is saying here is that actually the Palestinian Authority is an authoritarian one, and if people don't agree with what they're trying to do, then they are prepared to arrest, torture and incarcerate them.
Well, one of the things about being in a war situation, Tony, as we've just been saying, is that the niceties of political debate get crushed. Hamas actually won the last election in Palestine that was held across both territories, but nobody will recognise them because Israel won't recognise them, then nobody else is allowed to recognise them. Whereas, of course, in Sisi didn't win the election in Egypt. He did win an election, but his opposition were all dead or in prison and they weren't allowed to stand. But of course he's allowed to do that because he's our mate. But of course Hamas can't be recognised because Israel doesn't recognise him. So basically there are no rules, everybody's making up as they go along. There should be rules, but there aren't.
I know you're a big fan of China, but there's some pretty horrific reports this week out about these mass construction of detention centres over there. And let's have a listen now to BBC's John Sugworth. And it's just a little part of a report that he's done on these new Chinese detention camps for Xinjiang province, where the one he visited was designed for up to 10,000 people to be interned in there. And he actually visited it and spoke to some of the people who were visiting their relatives who'd been interned in this camp.
We found evidence of massive, new, highly secure facilities and evidence that they are part of a rapidly growing system right across the region. Of course, reports that China was detaining Muslims en masse in Xinjiang first began to emerge last year. There's already been some pretty credible evidence, one estimate putting the upper figure for those detained at just over 1 million. I think our evidence adds to that picture. And of course, recently, what we also have is, after months and months of outright denials, China finally starting to say something. Almost certainly in response to the rising international concern, state-run TV has been showing classrooms full of supposedly grateful adult Muslims willingly undergoing re-education, or anti-extremism training, as China calls it.
Without this, I might have followed religious extremism.
But new detailed satellite analysis seen by the BBC shows a different reality. In Xinjiang's western county of Yining last year, the school football pitch can be seen. Now, satellite photos show it covered in buildings, surrounded by watchtowers. There's a new high solid steel wall around the site and guards on the gate.
Let's ask.
On a corner just outside the camp fence, we stop to speak to a family. Some officials try to force them to leave, but another intervenes. Let them speak, she says. I ask who they're visiting. There's a pause, and then my dad, the young boy replies. Pretty quickly after that, we were asked to leave. Of course, China says it has a terrorism problem in Xinjiang. There have been attacks, of course, but this is a system that seems to target very broadly. People can be swept up into these facilities, we've learned, for the mildest of dissent, the most normal of religious activity, and interestingly, for any contact with Uyghurs, any contact at all with Uyghurs overseas is enough to get you detained. We tried to approach one giant suspected camp. It's one we'd seen on the satellite images, surrounded by 16 watchtowers.
There it is. That must be it over there.
The site is still being expanded on a huge scale.
Look at this. Wow.
Like a mini city rising from the desert, as we get closer, we can see row after row of new buildings, all of them four stories high.
They're still all following us, are they? How many have we got behind us? One, two, three, four still. Four including
the police car.
Four including the police car.
But then the police block our way.
So here we are then, just a few metres from the camp, and as predicted, we've been stopped. If this really is all about education, then why the effort to stop us getting close?
It's huge.
It's huge. But then they pull down the walls and they construct something much bigger.
The satellite analysts from the multinational aerospace company GMV have found dozens of similar, large, highly secure facilities.
Well, I listen to what's being said. The BBC are, you know, relatively reputable source of information. But of course, you know, what's really going on is opaque. Of course, in the past, China has run a very extensive prison camp system. No doubt they still do. Their worry, of course, is that Xinjiang province would break away from China. And they know that people from the region have been going to via Turkey into Syria. There's about 10,000 jihadi militants inside Syria at the minute who are from Xinjiang.
So why don't they make, getting involved in terrorism a crime and then put these people on trial? What's happening here is people are simply being interned without any kind of trial.
Well, I take your point, Tony. They may have legitimate concerns about terrorism, but that's not the way to deal with it. Now, I think this is fair comment about what China is doing, and China's got to think very carefully about what its strategy is here. Because brute force very rarely wins in this kind of situation.
Do you think internment, as it happened in Northern Ireland, for example, can be a real recruiting sergeant for the terrorists?
Well, indeed. And of course, I don't know what the thinking of the Chinese leadership is, or what the lie of the land is on the ground in Xinjiang. There may be a minority of extremists and a majority of moderates, or it may be that the Chinese have alienated so many people that there really is a chance that they could set up a separatist movement. But they work very close obviously those who are opposed to Chinese rule in Xinjiang with the MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence services, because of course they share a common language. This Turkic heritage runs across the whole of Central Asia.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, now we turn to the, I suppose, what should be, well, we mentioned the whole idea of international law, didn't we? The idea of war criminals going to jail. People like Tony Blair, people like George Bush, alleged war criminals, facing trial, having to answer questions. Well, this week I spoke to an international criminal court lawyer from The Hague who said he believes that they might rather poison defendants to death rather than allow them to be acquitted. He also explains who really runs the court. His name's Christopher Black and he's Canadian.
That's a very good question, but it means there are two sets of tribunals. There are the ad hoc UN tribunals like the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals in Sierra Leone, which were under UN auspices but really controlled by the Americans and other Western intelligence agencies. And then there's the International Criminal Court, which only has jurisdiction back to 2003. And it only has jurisdiction for those countries which are members of the Rome Treaty. The United States signed on but then withdrew. Russia and China are not members of the treaty. Syria is not. Afghanistan is not. Although Afghanistan has now given permission to the ICC to do investigations.
But 2003 was the year of the illegal Iraq invasion. Surely that's
right
within the jurisdiction. Why haven't we seen Bush and Blair hauled before the courts?
Well, you can ask the prosecutors for the ICC that question, which we've asked, and they won't give you an answer. And it's quite clear that although the United States is not a member of the Rome Treaty and is not a member of that court, it controls, the EU and the United States control the staffing of that court, and they control key members of the staff in that court, and they really approve the judges, and the prosecutors appointed by the Americans, no matter that they're not involved in it, technically speaking. The present prosecutor, Fatima Bensouda, was a former prosecutor at the Rwanda Tribunal and spent her career covering up U.S. war crimes in Africa. So they control the mechanisms of these tribunals, so there's no way that they can be charged, even if you could assume some sort of jurisdiction.
Well, this is worrying, isn't it? I mean, I was in Holland recently and speaking to just an average guy who was running a fish shop in the Hook of Holland, and he was saying how my father, who's still alive, his father lived through the war, and he said the thing my father always says is that the people in charge in The Hague now were on the wrong side during World War II. You've been involved, I know, in The Hague. You haven't given up, like many of us might, but you've been involved in both the Rwanda and the Yugoslavia cases. Can you just take us through those?
Well, I got involved first at the Rwanda Tribunal. I was my involvement came this way, briefly. When NATO attacked Yugoslavia, I was very angry about that in Toronto. We had big protests here against that. Massive protests. So I looked around for some other lawyers. What can we do as lawyers to try and do something against NATO? And there was a group here led by Michael Mandel, a professor at a law school here, who wrote the famous book, How America Gets Away with Murder. He led our team, and we filed war crimes charges against NATO at the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague. Because at that time, the prosecutor was Louise Arbour, who was one time my professor of criminal law and was a colleague of these other guys. Anyway, she turned us down, froze us out, and acted really as a policewoman for NATO and charged Milosevic just at the time when the French and the Germans wanted to stop the attack and conclude some sort of peace deal. So she arranged with Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton an indictment against Milosevic. So he became a quote-unquote war criminal and therefore could not be negotiated with, and the war continued. So that allowed the war to continue and justified the war in their propaganda. All the charges against Milosevic were absolutely false. And it turned out he proved that during the trial. I got involved in 2000. I was asked by the American Association of Jurists to go to Belgrade to do an investigation onto his arrest, whether it was a political arrest or not. And I found out that it was, in my opinion. They let me speak to the new pro-NATO, pro-fascist government they had installed there after the war. And their Minister of Justice told me to my face that the charges against Milosevic were false, but they had to arrest him because the Americans demanded it, and if they did not, they were going to be bombed again. And then he was shanghaied and taken to The Hague in an RAF plane and framed up with false charges, and he spent the rest of his life defending himself against those charges till he died in his prison cell under mysterious circumstances. At the same time, I got asked to defend a Rwandan general who was the head of the national police in Rwanda. And if you accept the standard narrative in the media about Rwanda, you compare the government there to the Nazis, he would be a Himmler, head of the Gestapo. But he was acquitted of about 60 counts of genocide. And if you ask yourself, how could a man be acquitted of 60 counts of genocide who ran a national police force? Well, then you have to ask, was any of that narrative true? Because it wasn't. In fact, it was another, same as Yugoslavia, the Americans backed a proxy force like they're doing in Syria to attack a semi-socialist government, overthrow it, blame the government for war crimes, justify the installation of their puppet regime and keep it there since. And it's still under a dictatorship of Paul Kagame, who's murdered millions in the Congo since. That's how the system works. And I was lucky enough, or maybe unlucky enough, depending how you look at it, to get involved in those cases. And it's taken up the last 15 years of my life. And what I've learned about what goes on in the international criminal justice system is enough to disgust even the most optimistic person, because the people that say they're trying to control war crimes and stop war, in fact, the ones who are committing them, they're the ones who commit the war crimes. They're the ones who find scapegoats, and they're the ones who spend their lives covering up their crimes and blaming others for them.
What do you make of the media coverage? Surely some of the things would have come out, like, for example, the mysterious death of Milosevic in custody. Well, most people look at that and think, well, surely he was poisoned in his jail cell.
Right. Well, I think he was, personally. We don't have definite concrete proof of that, but there is a report. The only report done on his death was done by the NATO tribunal itself, the ICTY. It's called the Parker Report because of the judge involved named Parker. And even in that report, which is very pro-NATO and tries to wash their hands of any responsibility, they indicate that there were two drugs in his body which should not have been there and can't be explained. It may have had a role in his death. One was a narcotic, and one was a drug which expedites the deterioration of other drugs in the body. They accelerate the breakdown of chemicals in the body. So, and he wrote a letter 3 days before he died, to the Russian embassy saying he was being poisoned. But he died before the letter could be acted upon. So I'm convinced he was poisoned. And the reason why is because he had won the case. He demolished the false charges against him. So they had one of three choices. Let him acquit him and let him go back into politics, which would be a major blow to NATO and would totally prove to the world there was no justification for the war against Yugoslavia. And he would be a major force again. Or falsely convict him, which would raise lots of questions because there's no evidence to convict him. Or they kill him. They eliminate him, and that's what happened. They couldn't let him go, and they couldn't convict him, so he died.
So could you just go through briefly what the sort of charges were against him and how they fell apart?
Well, they first arrested him in Belgrade on corruption charges, claiming he'd stashed away billions. I was told by the investigating judge on that case that it was all false. He had nothing. He had no money. At The Hague, they charged him, the indictment changed over time. It was initially for some alleged massacres in Kosovo that his forces were alleged to have been involved in. That fell apart. And then they charged him with vague conspiracy charges of conspiring to create a greater Serbia, as if that's a war crime. It may be a political, I don't know, issue, but they alleged that's a war crime. In fact, it wasn't true in any event. But he demolished all these charges, and he had lots of support from very high people testifying on his behalf. And all the charges, like Jeffrey Nice, the British prosecutor, was lying pretty much every day in the court there. He said the Kosovo field speech in which he alleged Milosevic said he was pro-Serbian nationalist speech was actually a speech in favor of eclecticism and ethnic diversity. It's the exact opposite of what Jeffrey Nice said it was when you listen to it. So the whole case fell apart. There was nothing against it. They were just fake charges to justify the bombing.
Well, as you know, Tony, I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia during that era. And I listened with interest to Christopher Black's analysis of what happened. What I would say about the International Criminal Court is that the United States has always insisted that it won't be part of the International Criminal Court because they have no intention whatsoever of their people ever being accused of war crimes.
So in other words, they're appointing the judges.
Oh, yeah. So in other words, the International Criminal Court is basically a kangaroo court which will basically go after people the West doesn't like, and that's about it. And, of course, the others conclude that there's not much point participating in it. I think the Russians have withdrawn from it for exactly the same reason, because if the Americans don't want to be part of it because they don't want to risk their people being sent, the Americans, let's be clear, they're not prepared to recognise any supranational jurisdiction over their nationals. And in that case, there's not the point of having international institutions at all.
What about the UN Security Council?
Well, the UN Security Council, has different members on it, and they've got different attitudes. Most of some of them are members of the International Criminal Court, Britain, France and Germany, and some of them aren't.
It seems like Milosevic's big crime was to be running an independent country.
Well, the point is he was a political operator in Yugoslavia amongst with a lot of other political operators. And if you're going to criminalise people for doing politics, then you're going to find it really difficult to resolve any political situations, aren't you?
Overall, isn't it simple that Yugoslavia was a massive travesty by NATO? Really the sort of crime that we've seen, the worst regimes in history, like the Nazis, just totally taking on a country and destroying it and breaking it up for their own purposes?
Well, let's face it, it was a very complex situation because you've got a number of different republics there with a number of different politics and so on. But of course, outside forces, particularly the Western imperialist powers, were determined to destroy independent socialist Yugoslavia, and by God, they succeeded.
Anyway, I think one of the things we'll definitely do, I had it ready for this week, but no time for it, is a real look at the East India Company and their role in the past in creating and fermenting wars, particularly after the revelations last week of these death squads in Yemen, run by private companies, funded by the Pentagon. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, former Bradley Stoke councillor, now UKIP National Executive Ben Walker, also former squatter Rick Carey. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib. What is the power of music? And how does it help children to cope with the harsh daily realities of living and growing up under military occupation?
I mean, Shahada saw one of his best friends shot dead when they went to try to escape the curfew, break the curfew to get bread. And his best friend was shot and killed right beside him. And this family was very traumatized during the Second Intifada. So Rasha and Allah reported that there was a sense of protection they felt from the music. And Rasha herself, according to many people I talked to, went from a very angry, traumatized child to this self-respecting young woman and musician.
We will speak with veteran journalist and professor of communication and journalism at the University of Southern California, Sandy Tolan, about his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. The book tells the story of Palestinian musician Ramzi Hussein Abu Radwan and his music school, Al Qamanjati, Arabic for the violinist, as well as the intersection of music and resistance. Later in the program, war journalist Anna Batkin takes us to Afghanistan in her book, The World is a Carpet, four seasons in an Afghan village. To tell the story of ordinary Afghans who have endured decades of wars and occupation. All this coming up on Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Stay with us. What is the power of music and how does it inspire and transform the daily lives of the Palestinians living under occupation? USC communication professor and journalist Sandy Toland's new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, tells the story of Ramzi Hussein Abu Radwan, a child of the first Palestinian Intifada, whose El Qaman Jati Music Center teaches hundreds of Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank and refugee camps in Lebanon. Sandy Tolan told Malihi about where he first met Ramzi.
Well, it was actually around the time that I was doing research for what first was a radio documentary and then the book, The Lemon Tree. Mm-hmm. And it was 1998. And I saw these posters all over Ramallah of this little boy. Two pictures on the poster. One was a photograph of a little boy, 8 years old, throwing a stone in the first Palestinian Intifada in late 1987, early 88. And then juxtaposed with that was the same boy, except for he was now 18 and he was playing the viola. And beneath that it said, the Palestine National Conservatory of Music. Mm-hmm. It was an advertisement for the conservatory, but also, in a sense, for the notion of Palestinian freedom and independence. And that, at that time, although a lot of people were skeptical, most of the hopes around that time centered around the notion of a two-state solution, that it was really possible. People thought it was going to happen. And there was a lot of hope in the air. And so at that point, you know, I kept seeing these posters everywhere and then met Ramzi. I went with my wife at the time as a Palestinian journalist, and we went into Al-Amari refugee camp, and I just spent a lot of time with him. And what I remember most of all him saying is, you know, I asked him what his dream was, and he was a kid from the camps. He was raised by his impoverished grandparents, and he said, you know, my dream is to play in the first National Symphony of Palestine, and my dream is to open up music schools all over Palestine so that children know there's something besides a stone.
How old was he back then?
He was 18. And I thought, you know, this is a beautiful dream for a kid who was raised in a refugee camp. But sure enough, he then gets a scholarship to study in France, study the viola. And I kept in touch with him for a couple of years and then lost track until one night in a restaurant in Ramallah, where I was with a couple of my former Berkeley students by chance. You know, I hear my name being called across the restaurant, and I look, and there's Ramzi. I said, well, what are you up to? And he said, oh, well, I'm back from France, and I'm opening up music schools for the children of Palestine. That began the journey.
And he opened the music school, Al Qaman Jati, in 2005. He started thinking about it back in 2002.
Yeah, he was thinking and thinking and thinking, but he started actually experimenting and implementing and bringing some of his friends from France, fellow musicians, down to see what it would be.
Much of your book, The Children of a Stone, focuses on Ramzi Abu Radwan. When the first Intifada broke out in 1987, he was 8 years old.
Right.
He was raised by his grandparents who lived in the Al-Amari refugee camp on the outskirts of Ramallah. What was about his story, besides that poster that you saw, that compelled you to write 400-plus pages? Not just about him. It's also about the impacts of the occupation on ordinary people and also possibilities, as you said, that Palestinians do imagine even living under such hard conditions.
First of all, it's an amazing story. The story of Ramzi, story of a kid from a camp, a refugee camp, who grows up with this dream and then actually learns to play music and keeps his dream and then becomes sort of like a Pied Piper, and all these people start following his dream. He's a very inspiring person. And the fact that all these musicians from all over the world came to help him and all over Palestine was part of the appeal, and just the drama of doing something truly beautiful under such exceptionally harsh circumstances that being the Israeli military occupation of the Palestinians in the West Bank since 1967. So then it's the story also of these children and how Ramzi used to like to say, or still does, my reason for doing this is to protect these children from these soldiers. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, sort of sounds like a soundbite at first. Well, how can music do that? And then you start seeing the kids talk about it and the teachers talk about it. And, of course, Ramzi talking about it. And then I did some research, and there's a lot of studies that show that music can be truly transformative, not just in the moment that you're playing, but it gives you a different sense of who you are. It kind of unlocks something and helps you, you know, sort of reorient your circuitry in a way. And that's what was happening with a lot of these kids that was being reported to me and that I could see for myself at times. So all of that attracted me, but there's also, I think there are so many, there's so much denial in the general culture in America of, or just not any discussion of the impact of the occupation on the Palestinians. And basically, the daily reality of half the people in this conflict is essentially off the American radar screen. So what I thought this great story of Ramzi and the music school gave us an opportunity to do was tell that story in the process. Talk about the incredible hardships that these children have just going by in their daily lives. So it would be a way of explaining and exploring and documenting the occupation without it being in a polemic, without it being, you know, sort of speech making or a study. You could just see these kids at checkpoints and so on.
And I think you capture what you're trying to do in the prelude of your book, Over the Wall, to play Beethoven. Yeah. And it's Ghalandia military checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem in summer of 2003. This is about musicians who are trying to go to Jerusalem for a concert.
Yeah.
And because of the checkpoint and because of the wall, their movement is so restricted that they have to risk their lives in order to be able to go there.
I wanted people to get a sense immediately of the visceral feeling of what it's like to live in an occupied land. And yet, you know, what this sort of extraordinary mission of this group of musicians and, in fact, the book is, which is to talk about the efforts to make music under occupation and the extreme measures that people will go to. Just in this case, to play Beethoven's Fourth Symphony at a French church built in Crusaders times in the old city of Jerusalem. So the idea that you could have a story like this, you're kind of literally dangling in the air at the end of this section, and then what happens in the prelude, then the story is elaborated in five parts. So it's kind of a parallel drama to the rest of the book.
And also, as I said, at the time of the First Intifada in 1987, Ramzi was just only 8 years old. But his life in the refugee camp under occupation defined him. When did music enter his life?
Well, there were several places sort of early on. I mean, one of the things that he told me was, you know, his grandfather was a street sweeper. He was a municipal garbage worker. And at Ramzi's insistence, when he snuck around and followed his grandfather to work one morning, which is kind of how I opened the book, he really loved working with his grandfather. His grandfather was a refugee from the village of Nani in old Palestine. And he would just follow him around and sweep the streets with him. And he was like so impressed that his grandfather, he said, you know, his work was like holy. He was so devoted to his work, even though his work was in garbage. And they would find things on the street that they would salvage and bring home, or maybe they would patch up some clothes and sell them or whatever. And one day they found a teddy bear on the street. And Ramzi pulled it, and it played the notes of the Ode to Joy from Beethoven, the Ninth Symphony. And he used to play it at night while his grandfather was sleeping. And they shared the same bed often. So that was one moment. And then there was a moment where there was a fellow who they called Teacher Holiday. Teacher Holiday was maybe second grade, something like this. And one day he bought out a box of instruments and gave him maracas and tambours or whatever, and he brought out his kamanja or his violin, And Ramsey said, you know, his whole face, his whole being was transformed by that. And Ramsey looked, and that's part of what gave him that idea of being a musician. But it wasn't really something that he had in his mind until he had a concrete opportunity at age 16 or so.
And you have a passage in the book that sort of parallels his own experience when he was a little kid with what he saw when he was talking to a group of kids in a school for the disabled in the West Bank. And that is when the idea for this music school suddenly, it sparked in his right. mind that, what if I do that? And I thought that was one of the most beautiful passages in the book because of the relationship that he really developed instantaneously with these kids.
Right.
And he could observe how transformative music can be. And I would like you to read it if possible.
Sure. A few days after his arrival from France, Ramsey sat in a chair at the front of a classroom at the Center for Rehabilitation, a small school where handicapped and able-bodied children learn together. He smiled at the children, his bouzouk in his lap. In the same refugee camp 17 years earlier, he had watched teacher Halady open the magic cabinet full of musical instruments. Ramsey looked around the room at the artwork taped onto the walls. In front of him was a large scroll of butcher paper, partly unrolled across a 10-foot patch of floor, revealing the children's artwork. Between the images of birds and trees, orange fire exploded from tank barrels. Soldiers confronted mothers and children at checkpoints. Houses burned. Ramsey had visited classrooms in France, too, and there the children just drew houses, sun, and trees. Children are children, the same everywhere, he believed. They draw what they see. Ramsey began to strum his bouzouk, playing a soft instrumental version of Il Khalwadi, the beautiful girl. He played folk and revolutionary songs for 30 minutes, then went home, looking up at the red roofs of Psagot, the Israeli settlement on the old hill of Jabal al-Tawil. Recently, at the height of the Second Intifada, the settlement had begun marketing Kava Vin Psago to Jews in Israel and beyond. A website boasted of a Cabernet Sauvignon aged in a special cave containing winemaking implements that date to at least to the time of the Second Temple. A few days after his visit, Ramsey returned to the school for rehabilitation. This time, the children surrounded him, wide-eyed, touching the bouzouk. One by one, Ramsey would play a note, then reach out for a child's hand, placing his or her finger on the fingerboard. In this way, the children could hear the change in pitch. "Hey, this is magic," someone shouted. This was the same feeling Ramsey had experienced as a boy, staring open-mouthed as teacher Halady transformed himself into a kamanjati, a violinist. Before he left, Ramsey looked out onto the scroll of butcher paper, where days earlier he had seen images of rockets, tanks, and mothers in distress. Now he watched children trying to draw musical instruments, violin, bouzouk, and oud. In the moment, Ramsey had a simple epiphany tied to his history and his music. "I thought it would be more useful for your country if you're still alive, you know, than if you die, killed by a soldier in the beginning of your life." Now, he thought, his idea, which he dreamed of calling Al-Kamanjati, the violinist, could actually work. Previously, the school had existed in the abstract. Now, with children in a war zone drawing musical instruments after hearing Ramsey play for only half an hour, he saw that music could help safeguard his people's children. "Next year," he said to himself, "I will come back, and I will do the work."
This was in 2002, and 3 years later, he established the school in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the only music school. You write that after the 1994 Oslo Agreement, tens of thousands of Palestinians long exiled by Israel were able to come back. And among those was Mohammed Fadel, mm-hmm. a violinist trained in musical therapy and established the National Conservatory of Music in Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 years later, in 1998, Professor Edward Said, together with Israeli pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim, also created West Eastern Divan Orchestra. And the title is based on a set of poems by Goethe. These Western-centric music projects had different missions. And you also have Kamanjati that came out later in 2005. So for someone like Ramsey, who grew up in a refugee camp and had experienced First Intifada, he was a stone thrower himself, one day he's going to the conservatory, but on his way he sees a car filled with settlers coming down the alley, and he throws several stones at them, and then he just turns back and just goes to school and doesn't talk about it. Resisting the occupation was an organic part of their being. So where did he fit? Where did he, someone like Ramsey, fit in this new environment before he started this school, of course?
Well, I think it works on several levels. One is he never stopped playing Arabic music. He never stopped playing the bouzouk. It was always the bouzouk and the viola. His formal training as a classical musician, of course, was with the viola, which began in Ramallah at the National Conservatory of Music, which is now the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music. So he was always in both worlds of music, Arabic or so-called Oriental music, and classical, Western classical music. And, you know, Ramsey would say, nobody owns Beethoven. He belongs to the world. So he doesn't make such distinctions. But I think what was also a practical matter was that these scholarships were giving a chance for him to do something different with his life. It could have been, if he had a propensity for art, maybe it would have been something else, or writing. I mean, he just was drawn to music, had the opportunity, and this was a way for him to become something outside. The interesting thing is he could have had a career as a classical musician in Europe. And he had that opportunity, and yet he was always grounded in his dream, which was to come back and bring that to his own people. So in a way, he used his training as a tool to do what he wanted to do all along.
He was a student at the National Conservatory of Music, of course, and he played with Divan. And at some point, Ramsey's vision about the role played by music in the lives of Palestinian kids diverged and clashed with that of West Eastern Divan Orchestra. How did these different music projects see the relationship between music and politics in general and occupation in particular?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, one is that when Edward Said died, I think that Maryam Said took on his widow took on a very large role in organizing. But I think nevertheless, especially a liaison to the Arab musicians in the orchestra, which these are musicians coming from Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, as well as Palestine and other places. But I think that the dynamic shifted a little bit. And I know a number of the Arab musicians felt like it was becoming more of an Israeli-dominated orchestra. I don't know personally if that's true, but I've certainly heard people talk about that. I think what happened, you know, Ramsey felt that Daniel Barenboim was personally quite courageous in the stances that he would take. You know, he accepted a major prize, Israeli prize, and took the opportunity of the speech to denounce the occupation. I mean, not everybody would do that. But he did not agree with Ramsey that the orchestra itself should also take a stand and denounce the occupation. And Ramsey spent quite a while trying to convince the rest of the orchestra that we have to make a stand. We have to. And then after there was the Lebanon War broke out in 2006 and Israel was attacking Lebanon, there were Lebanese people in the orchestra. A lot of people didn't show up. And that was the first year Ramsey was there. And he's like, wait a minute, I thought you guys were progressive, and I don't see that you want our freedom. And so he started questioning it, and he kept trying to sort of reform the organization. But Daniel and even Maryam Said both agreed that the example of the orchestra before the world, that there can be harmony, is power enough. And Ramsey disagreed. He said, that's not power enough, because I need to know that everyone in this orchestra believes in my freedom. And I think in the end, he did leave the Divan. And although he remains, I think, quite fond of Daniel Barenboim, they just had differences, philosophical differences. And I think, you know, I've interviewed both of them at length, particularly Ramsey, but also Daniel Barenboim several times. And You know, you can tell they really like each other, but they just had this irreconcilable difference over the role of the orchestra and whether it should make a more pronounced stand behind the Palestinians.
It was intensified with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
That's absolutely
because
true.
Because Daniel Barenboim did not understand what it was all about, if I'm not mistaken. He says something to that effect in the book.
What's interesting, and sort of serendipitously, the narrative of the Divan Orchestra and Ramzi's involvement in it and his disagreement with Daniel Barenboim that we were just talking about parallels the deterioration in the situation on the ground in Palestine, and in particular the erosion of the sort of Oslo-era dialogue. You know, let us just understand each other's pain and history, and let's be a witness to each other. That was a big, you know, I personally think that that can be extremely powerful. But for Palestinians, they note that at the beginning of the dialogue era, if you want to call the Oslo era, which was signed on the White House lawn, the Accords, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in 1993, there were then 109,000 settlers on the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem. Today, there are 350,000. Mm. There are more bypass roads. The lands of Palestinians are like an archipelago of islands. And so Palestinians understandably ask, what did this get us? What is all this dialogue and witness to each other? And so the direct confrontation, nonviolent action of the BDS movement and of Palestinian state efforts to join the UN and the International Criminal Court are responses to the situation on the ground and the fact that Israel has not been negotiating a two-state solution in good faith, and the two-state solution is essentially dead now. Mm. So I think Daniel Barenboim wants to still think that we should be in that era of dialogue. And I think a lot of people don't realize that that era has been pretty much discarded by Palestinians because it didn't work.
It was Sharon who said that I'm going to turn the West Bank and Gaza into pastrami sandwich.
Yeah. Layers of settlement.
Exactly. Layers of settlements. And you say that Daniel Barenboim took this personally.
Yes.
You write that it was difficult for Daniel not to take it personally. As an individual, he had repeatedly put himself on the line in his own country for advocating for Palestinian cause, declaring solidarity with the plight of occupied Palestine. What was it about boycott, divestment, and sanctions that Mr. Barenboim did not understand?
I can't speak to that specifically.
Did you talk to him about this?
I talked to him in general. I'd have to go back to my notes. I don't recall if I asked him about his opinion about BDS. But I think in general, I mean, he's pretty much of a two-state solution person. Of course, their BDS does not insist that one be a one-state solution person. But I think that he has not made the conversion to the sort of post-Oslo direct nonviolent confrontation of Israel and the strategy of essentially shaming Israel in the international arena. I think that goes beyond his comfort zone. If I can't say exactly what his position on BDS is, but I would say for that reason, he probably is beyond his comfort zone. Mm.
You also feature several kids who go to Al-Kamanchati.
Yeah.
And some young girls and the difficulties they face.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of these wonderful young men and women that you met along the way as you were writing this book?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, that's part of what inspired me to keep going and try to make this into a really page-turning tale, because I feel committed to telling their story accurately and with heart. And I'm happy to tell you about a few of them. I mean, the girl who's on the cover of the book is Ala Shalalda. She was the first student at Ramzi School. She wandered in one day when he had all his school set up and it's beautiful and all the instruments, but no students. You know, he was told me he was sort of twiddling his thumbs at first. And what do I do now? And here's this little girl, 7 years old, who wanders in and Ramzi's playing his violin and or his viola. And she's like, whoa, why do you play it like that? And he's like, come over here. Why don't you look in the rooms and see what looks good to you? And she started touching the piano, and she had never seen a piano before it arrived, and a month or so earlier, and except for, she told me, on a Tom and Jerry cartoon. And then she picked up the violin, and he said, you know, that's a lot of work, the violin. And she said, you know, I don't care. I will do it. I will do the work, too. So that's one girl. Her older sister, Rasha, was quite a talented flute player. And their older brother, Shahada, has become the instrument maker of Al-Kamanjati, the luthier and the instrument repair guy. You know, Rasha had an opportunity to be the first girl from Al-Kamanjati to study abroad. And the family was not, especially the father and Shahada, the oldest brother, was not comfortable with her studying unaccompanied. And so he opposed her scholarship. And that became very tense in the family. But then Rasha got married, and she's still playing the flute. And she's got a degree in journalism now, I believe. So, and she's got, I think her boy is maybe 5 years old now. So, but they're living near in the ancestral village near Hebron.
How did music impact their lives? At some point, I think it was Ala, she says that when she plays the instrument, she feels very calm.
Yeah.
And she sort of transports herself into a completely different world, which doesn't look anything like her real life.
But Rasha talked about how I just feel, yes, transported, like I'm in the forest with this blue lake, beautiful sea, not like the Dead Sea, and I feel the sense of freedom. And all of these people around her reported, you know, that this very traumatized girl, traumatized during the Israeli incursions in the Second Intifada, along with Allah and the whole family. I mean, Shahada saw one of his best friends shot dead when they went to try to escape the curfew, break the curfew to get bread, and his best friend was shot and killed right beside him. And this family was very traumatized during the Second Intifada. So Rasha and Allah reported that there was a sense of protection they felt from the music. And Rasha herself, according to many people I talked to, went from a very angry, traumatized child to this self-respecting young woman and musician.
And also for Ramzi, Al-Kamanjati school was also a model of resisting the Israeli occupation. So he would take sometimes these kids, or he will try to take them to the checkpoint. Was he ever concerned about taking these young kids to the checkpoint and having them face Israeli soldiers?
Well, there was a discussion about that. There was a similar incident where they were thinking about crossing the line between Israel and the West Bank, in one of the few places where there's not a wall still, in this beautiful village of Batir. And there was a big fight about whether or not they should go, and Ramzi wanted to provoke and wanted to go. And other people were saying, well, what if a few of these teachers get arrested and they're banned from coming back? And, you know, then what happens to the school? And what if you're arrested, Ramzi? And so he relented and they didn't cross that line. I think there were other similar discussions. There have been some teachers, rather some parents, that have expressed some concerns. Mm-hmm. But I think Ramzi sees his work in music just as much as when he was a child throwing stones as a form of resistance. Mm-hmm. And so people will say, maybe they don't tell him into his face, but they'll say, Ramzi, you know, he's more political than musical. He's more into politics than he is into music. But for Ramzi, I don't think there's... You can't have one without the other. You can't live in a situation under the occupation and do anything that's not somehow a statement. And so, I mean, these kids, they wanted to do that. There's an amazing event at the Colandia checkpoint that I end the book at, where these kids are playing Mozart's Fourth Symphony. And little Allah, well, she was now, I guess she was probably 14 then when I talked to her about this. And she, after this concert, she had the most serene smile I have ever seen on her face, you know. And she could be kind of a frowning kid, sometimes brooding, you know. And she was only 14 at the time or whatever, but she's like, this was the best concert of my life, you know.
Sandy Tolan is an award-winning journalist, documentary radio producer, an associate professor at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC. He is the author of a number of books on Israel-Palestine, including The Lemon Tree, and his latest, Children of the Stone. Sandy Tolan is speaking this Saturday, June 6th, from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Bay Area Book Festival at the Brower Center, Tamil Pius Room in downtown Berkeley. For more information, visit baybookfest.org. We will put the link on our website at vomina.org. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. Khalil Bendib, and this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. When asked about the misconceptions about Afghan people, foreign correspondent Anna Botkin replies, quote, I think there isn't a whole lot of conception of the Afghan people. If you get your information about Afghanistan from television snippets, you see Afghans as two-dimensional figures in unfamiliar clothes that move across our television screens, foreign and strange, almost cartoon-like, unsung. One goes up, one goes down. At the very best, they are generalized as victims or evildoers. Most commonly, they are simply statistics. In her new book, The World is a Carpet, independent journalist and storyteller Anna Botkin chronicles how she spent a year in Oka, a village in northern Afghanistan which is not registered on any map, including maps of Afghanistan. Through a close observation of the ancient tradition of carpet weaving, Anna Botkin chronicles the daily lives of the 240 residents of this isolated village in all its complexities and simplicity. And she spoke about it with Melihe Razazan.
The village epitomizes Afghanistan to me. Most of Afghanistan is small villages that are not, maybe even if they are on the map, some regional map, they're not on the map of the Afghan government. They're definitely not on the map of the West that is conditioning life in Afghanistan. Much of Afghanistan lives rurally. 80% of Afghans live in villages. Much of Afghanistan has seen the effects of the billions of dollars in international aid that the West has poured into Afghanistan in the last 12 years. Conversely, much of Afghanistan has not seen the direct effects of the U.S.-led invasion. There aren't villages, or there are, but there are not a whole lot of that are bombed out. There are not a whole lot of villages that have been raided by NATO troops. However, war is omnipresent. Destruction is omnipresent in the way there is no infrastructure, in the way relief and health care are tremendously delayed. And so for that, Oka is very representative.
In your book, you say, I saw Oka in 2010 when I met Baba Nazar and his family and watched for the first time his daughter-in-law squat upon the loom. The visit had lasted an afternoon. I had to return. I had to return and spend more time here, the time it took to weave a carpet. What was about the weaving of a carpet that inspired you to go back and chronicle the daily lives of the 240 residents of this tiny village in northern part of Afghanistan?
Two main things. One is, in my work, what I try to do, explore the gray area within the tension between the devastation and the beauty, the poverty and the charity, the violence and the survival. And so for me, to be in this village that is absolutely destitute and forsaken and devastated in a way by millennia of war that has been waged upon the Afghan soil, and at the same time, where people produce such beauty that attracted me, that pierced me, the dissonance, the friction between the violence and the beauty. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that carpets, Afghan carpets, are familiar to my audience, which is an American audience or a Western audience. Probably a lot of people who are listening to us have Afghan carpets in their living rooms. So this was an opportunity for me to tell a story from a very unfamiliar angle, because the story is told out of Afghanistan. It's not me looking into Afghanistan. It's me trying to look out of Afghanistan, tell the land, tell the journey of this year the way Afghans see it, but at the same time throwing a very familiar line, if you will, a thread, a carpet yarn, to my audience, something that is familiar, a common denominator, something that people who are reading this book in English in the United States can say, oh, this brings it home. So for that, carpets were important.
You know, there is a passage in your book where you describe Thara, who is a carpet weaver in Oka, about how the pattern, the color, the thickness of the carpet reflects her daily life in Oka.
A carpet weaver in Afghanistan, unless she works in a factory, if she's working from home, she performs a very difficult job, but it's not slave labor. It's not morning to dusk, hour after hour, day after day, monotonous, never standing up. No, it's part of her life. So she's a carpet, but she's also a mother and a daughter and a daughter-in-law and a sister. And she also probably has to look after some animals, maybe some chicken. And so she also has to maybe cook lunch for her husband. So when she does sit down at the loom, she's interrupted very frequently. Her baby cries. She needs to stand up and make sure that the baby's okay, maybe nurse the baby. Or a neighbor walks into the loom room and starts telling sex gossip from the newlywed's house, and the women start laughing, and the weaver is once again distracted. Or the weaver's sister gets married in a nearby village, and the weaver leaves the carpet for a couple of weeks. So all this happens with the carpet participating in it. For example, she gets distracted. She forgets the count of the knots that she's tied so far and accidentally weaves an extra petal to an almond. Or she gets distracted and misses a leaf, or she spills her tea upon the carpet. Her baby is born upon the carpet. Chicken walk onto the carpet, and she has to shoo them away. You know, their bird droppings and their feathers get stuck in the weave, and all of that is accumulated in that weave. So the carpet becomes more than a decoration. It becomes the diary of this woman at the loom.
And I think something you said in one of your interviews is that people who own an Afghan carpet, or for that matter, any carpet, really, you want them to look at all those designs and patterns and think about who made them and what went into making a carpet.
I hope that my audience, regardless of whether they have carpets, will try to imagine what life in Afghanistan is like. I hope that the book helps transport them for an afternoon or an hour, however long they take to read the book, to this land that is not as far away as we want to think. It's much closer. It's very familiar.
And I want to read that passage that you were just describing. I think it's so beautiful. You say, here the weaver ran out of burgundy yarn and switched to the crease left over from some older weaving. The depth of color in the border changes suddenly. Here a goat ambled into the loom room and the weaver jumped up to shoo it away. The lotus flower grew an extra petal here. She forgot the count of the knots she had already tied before she settled back to work. So can you talk about the journey that this carpet takes from a hut in Oka to a living room in Europe or in the United States?
The carpet is rolled up, pile side in, and thrust into a pannier of a donkey. And then the weaver's husband or father-in-law or brother, a male from her family, takes the carpet to the nearest carpet merchant in the nearest town. That carpet merchant buys the carpet probably for $200 or $300. And then that carpet merchant in turn sells that carpet to a merchant in a larger city, for example, in Mazar-e-Sharif, which is the largest city in northern Afghanistan. From there, the carpet has three directions in which it can go. It can go south to Kabul, probably by bus in the cargo hold of a passenger bus over the Hindu Kush Mountains, Kabul to the airport and to Dubai by plane, and from there it can go directly to London or New York or Washington, D.C. or San Francisco or Frankfurt. Or the carpet can travel from Mazar-e-Sharif west on the old Great Silk Road to Turkmenistan and from Turkmenistan to Turkey, where it will end up in the Grand Bazaar of Istanbul, where a tourist might buy it or maybe somebody from a wealthy Turkish family might buy it. Or the carpet may travel via Kabul to Jalalabad, which is a town on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then cross the border over Khyber Pass and end up in Peshawar. Usually carpets from Peshawar also end up in the west. So most of these routes bring the carpet to a Western consumer. Mm.
And you actually took that journey with the carpet to Kabul, and then from Kabul to Jalalabad, try to find those carpets that end up there.
I followed the carpet route to the borders, both with Turkmenistan and with Pakistan. I did not actually cross, because the purpose of this journey, the purpose of this book, was not to follow a carpet. The purpose of the book was to tell a story of Afghanistan the way Afghans themselves see it. So I did journey to Jalalabad and actually past Jalalabad to the Khyber Pass that connects Pakistan or separates Pakistan from Afghanistan, depending on your philosophical view. And I also traveled to the border north of Andhoy in western Afghanistan to the border with Turkmenistan.
So let's talk about people you met in Oka and you wrote about. Something that has struck me was that everyone in Oka smokes opium. Women drink it with their tea and men smoke it. And you write about this infant, Zakurullah, who was taken to the hospital because he had some degree of opium poisoning and he was dying, basically, but they were able to save him. And you also write about boys in Oka who are allowed to smoke opium when they turn 15 years old. Or they get married, whichever comes sooner. So why is opium consumption so pervasive in this village?
Because it's the most available and often the only available medicine in Oka. The nearest hospital is a 7.5-hour walk from Oka. So if somebody in Oka gets ill, the only medicine, painkiller, the only reliever of woe available to that person is opium. Opium is supposed to have been brought to Afghanistan by an invader, by Alexander the Great. His army used opium as a palliative. Mm. And opium remained and remains today in places like Oka, which have no other access to health care, a predominant palliative. Malihe, children in Oka die because the wells in Oka are diseased. Mm. Children in Oka die because of a common cold. Mm. Children in Oka die because of dysentery in the summer and the flu in the winter. Also, women will take opium to stave off hunger, give opium to their children to stave off hunger.
What about the issues of electricity and water? Because there is, again, one passage in your book that you talk about the generator that was brought in to provide electricity to the residents. And then when the generator ran out of diesel, it became so expensive to sustain it. Basically, it has just been sitting there and nobody even cares about using these generators. So first off, who brought this generator to Oka?
Nobody in Oka could really tell me who it was. The people who physically delivered the generator were Afghan. Mm. They probably belonged to some well-meaning NGO, or maybe some subcontractor working with an NGO. So they delivered the generator. They also built 12 aluminum electric poles and stretched a power line from one pole to the next and to the next. They did not connect the power line to anything else, nor did they connect it to the generator. The generator came and the villagers ran it nonstop to calculate how much it would cost them to run it every evening for, say, a couple of hours. And once they ran out of fuel, they realized that it would be simply too expensive to use a generator because nobody in the village has any money to spare. So they never used it after this one dry run 6 or 7 years ago. And I think that that generator stands there like a monument to the misguided effort to renovate or resurrect, rebuild Afghanistan. Because here it is, you know, the effect, the tangible effect of international relief, international aid, the generator that cannot run because nobody can afford to run it. Mm. An absolutely useless piece of mechanics that will never be put to use because the people for whom it is intended simply can't afford it.
What about water?
There are water wells that have water. The water is diseased. It has tested positive for typhoid and a bunch of other diseases. So they use this diseased water that they draw hand over hand from these two fairly deep wells. All wells in northern Afghanistan are very deep because there is almost no surface water. It's a desert.
This place is not on the map of Afghanistan. Can you take us through this village and tell us what it looks like? And besides carpet weaving, what else people do in this village to make a living and to survive?
Oka is a tiny hamlet of about 40 cob homes that sit on top of a loess hummock. And around it is a convex desert that stretches to the north and the west and the east until it curves into the horizon. And in the south, it is trimmed by the Hindu Kush Mountains that are about 40, 50 miles away. Nothing grows in Oka because it doesn't have any surface water. It only has these two very, very deep wells. So there is absolutely no farming, no cultivation of anything at all. The two sources of income for the villagers are carpet weaving and bartering of caliganum, which is this thorny brush that grows in the desert, as kindling for rice and oil and flour, wheat flour. So men and boys will go into the desert with their camels and their donkeys and gather heapfuls of caliganum and pile it on top of their pack animals and take the animals to the nearest big villages where things do grow and trade the caliganum for basic necessities such as rice or oil or wheat flour or sugar or tea. And the women will weave carpets. It takes between 4 and 9 months to weave a carpet, depending on the size of the carpet and how many women are actually weaving it. So those are the two pretty much only sources of income for the villagers.
were they surprised that someone from the United States is interested in their story?
I don't know if they were surprised. They were certainly curious because they couldn't understand what it is that I was doing. Nobody in Accra, except for the owner of a very small bodega, can read. So the idea that I was writing a book about Accra is very difficult to convey to the villagers. And one time, one of my friends there asked me, why is it that I come to Accra? Because she thought that it was such a difficult place to be, and he had to be there, but I didn't. Hmm. So why did I choose to come there? And I said, and this was around the time of the tsunami that hit Japan in 2011, and the villagers were listening to the radio and listening to the news from Japan. And I said, you know how listening to the news from Japan and you're imagining what it's like to be there right now? Well, in order for you to hear the stories from Japan, somebody like me has to be in Japan and tell these stories. And so what I'm doing here in Accra is I'm trying to record your story so that I can tell it to people in the United States. And the next time somebody asked my friend what Anna is doing in our village, my friend said, she's going to talk about us. And here I am talking about Accra on the radio. Hmm. So in a way, he was absolutely correct.
I was surprised to read that even Taliban is not interested in this village.
The village has nothing to offer. The Taliban is only interested in places where they can either hide and you... Well, there are no trees in Accra, so it's rather difficult to hide there, or where you can collect a tithe, a 10% religious tax. And of course, in a village that has no money, there is nothing to collect. Mm. So, of course, the Taliban is not interested in Accra.
But at the same time, when there was that wedding, the musicians never showed up because Amin Bai in Accra, he told you they were afraid. He clarified by saying that they were afraid of Taliban because 6 months earlier, you write, in Torai, Taliban gunmen had opened fire during a wedding because there had been live music and dancing. Now musicians avoided traveling to weddings in villages they did not know well. Even some wedding photographers in Kabul cannot take wedding pictures and they get threatened by Taliban.
Yes, there actually have been assaults on wedding photographers and assaults on wedding musicians because, of course, and assaults on photographers, by the way, were not necessarily by the Taliban. Sometimes the family of one of the sides in the wedding is more conservative than the other, and they disapprove of the notion that somebody would photograph the bride, for example. Mm. It's not the Taliban alone who are very traditional. Much of Afghanistan society is very traditional, very conservative. The wedding I attended, all the guests were asked to not use their cell phones because everybody has a cell phone with a little camera on it, and the villagers wanted to protect the dignity of their families and the dignity of their wives and daughters and sisters and make sure that none of the women in the wedding were photographed by the male guests. So the idea of not photographing at the wedding doesn't just come from the Taliban, which is, you know, just one representation of conservative thinking.
Hmm. Anna, your book reads like a poem as it describes the simplest and the most complex parts of life in this small village, Accra, in northern Afghanistan. And I really had to slow down in order to be able to adjust myself to the rhythm of life in this village. Was that intentional?
I'm glad you're saying that the book made you slow down, because I think in order to survive Afghanistan, we must slow down. On the one hand, time, the way we perceive it in the West, is irrelevant in Afghanistan, because in a way, Afghanistan itself is timeless. Its perpetual wars timeless. And Western time really means nothing in the Khorasan because it abides by its own clock. It's a clock of snow, of spring, of kidding news, the clock of Ramadan, the clock of the spring solstice celebrations. So when you come to Afghanistan, you sense, if you allow yourself to let go of your preconceived setup of time, the time will pull and unfurl in the valleys and crevices around you at a pace that has been set by millennial wars, by ancient connections, by harvests, by scars, by conflicts, by celebrations. But at the same time, Afghanistan doesn't exist outside time. That would be a conceit, because it doesn't exist outside the world, except the way Afghanistan travels with time is it speeds itself up and then slows down to the condition, to the cadence of life itself. So, for example, the landmarks, the milestones of time in Afghanistan are a wedding, a Taliban attack on the United Nations compound, the seizure of a certain village by insurgents, you know, maybe the killing of Osama bin Laden, or maybe not. And what I was trying to do with writing the book in the very particular rhythm was to allow my audience to adjust to this time, to adjust to this pace that Afghanistan set.
Anna Botkin is an award-winning freelance war correspondent who has covered conflicts in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Since 2001, she has reported regularly from Afghanistan, the setting of her new book, The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village, in which she chronicles the lives of the residents of Oka, a small village in northern Afghanistan. She spoke with Melihe Razazan. To learn more, visit jadmagazine.com. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632, email vomekpfa@yahoo.com, connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report, October 2018. Only 12 years left to save ourselves. Even though the October 8, 2018 release of the latest IPCC report was meant to jolt humanity into action, to bring down carbon dioxide emissions within 12 years, to avoid global catastrophe, a stunned silence fell upon most of the world's media. Two scientists who have been on TUC Radio before are imploring us to notice that the IPCC's report is not urgent enough. They are Peter Wadhams, Emeritus Professor of Polar Ocean Physics, Cambridge University, and Professor Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, University of Manchester. He's currently teaching at Uppsala University, Sweden. My thanks go out to Stuart Scott with the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! For giving them a voice. Here first is Professor Peter Wadhams, interviewed by Stuart Scott.
So the IPCC, which has been notably underestimating the severity and the speed for the past 30 years, now they seem to be getting with the program. This report is more properly alarming.
Yes, it is alarming, but in a sense it has to be, because the IPCC has tended to be quite complacent in the way that it's handled global warming and soft-pedaled on certain kind of self-reinforcing feedbacks that I worry about and a lot of people worry about, are feedback mechanisms which are liable to eventually lead us to some sort of runaway warming. Mm-hmm. And those are things like the methane feedback, the sea level rise feedback, the albedo feedback. IPCC has tended to soft pedal on those to the extent of actually forgetting some of them or hoping they don't exist by not mentioning them.
Don't pay any attention to that man behind the curtain in the corner of the room.
And if they're uncertain what its magnitude will be, then by not mentioning it, it sort of goes away entirely and you don't have to deal with it. And there's some classic cases there, like the case of methane from the offshore, whether that could expand to be a major threat. It won't, in the IPCC's view, because they don't consider it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the new report, you hope that they've mended some of these, but they've mended some of them, but not all. And really, they still have the same mental view that we just need to do more of the same and even more of the same to keep temperatures down to 1.5 rather than 2. So it's still, there's a big stress on CO2 emissions reduction, except that it's so obvious that at 1.5 you have to focus on carbon dioxide removal.
Do they talk about emissions, not just reductions, about withdrawal, about carbon withdrawal in this new report?
They do, yes, but they don't go into the magnitude of the reduction that's going to be needed. I mean, they say, well, we will have to have CO2 removal from the atmosphere. What they ought to be doing is going into how much CO2 removal per year is going to be needed to keep the warming down to 1.5. And that number is very large. It's at least 20 billion tons. I mean, it's about 40 or 50% of what our present emissions are, is the amount we have to just take out of the atmosphere to keep the warming down below 1.5. And that's such a massive commitment, such a kind of a huge industry is going to be needed that will change everybody's life, that it needs to be considered as part of the warning. I mean, the warning's not meant to be just a warning, watch out or else. The mm-hmm. warning should be, look, unless we do this, we've had it, but this is what we have to do. They really still soft pedal on these tipping points, the self-reinforcing feedbacks. And one of them, I'm just reading what they say, is, of course, sea ice, which I know most about. You look for what they say about sea ice, and it's daft. They say that if we can keep global warming to 1.5 degree, then there'll be an ice-free summer only once every 100 years.
What?
Once every 100 years, we'll have an ice-free summer. But, of course, we know that from maybe next year, maybe the year after, we're going to have an ice-free summer and then nothing but ice-free summers. And that's nothing to doing with plus 1.5. It's the situation as it is now. As well as saying ice-free summers once every 100 years at 1.5, they say that if we let the temperature rise to 2 degrees, there'll be an ice-free summer every 10 years. But even that is, again, equally daft, because we know that that's not the case. This is the kind of thinking of the old-fashioned modellers, the ones who were way behind the curve and saying we wouldn't have ice-free conditions until the end of the century. That sort of modelling, one thought they would be embarrassed enough by reality to withdraw that kind of a modelling approach. But here it is back again, pretending that the situation isn't the way it is. And I notice that there isn't a sea ice, a well-known sea ice researcher's name on the author list. So presumably the authors looked up what was the conventional wisdom. They said, oh, yeah, the models say it won't disappear until the end of the century. We'll put that down. But it's wrong. So when there's something like that, something as serious as that, that they get completely wrong, then one doesn't feel too confident about the rest.
You mentioned before three of the areas that are overlooked or deleted that could be runaway cycles in themselves. Can you list them again?
First is the emission of methane from the Arctic offshore. And that's always been a bugbear because IPCC has always ignored it. Mm-hmm. And yet that potentially is a very, very serious threat. And they likewise ignore it in this report.
Your conjecture as to why they ignore it is that it can't be modeled. And so they ignore those who do go there, the expeditionary scientists like yourself and Dr. Shakova. So we'll base it on the models, which say the methane's not supposed to be coming out for 50 or 100 years.
That's it. And it is pretty scandalous. Whenever you get some outrageously terrible thing happening, something that has been predicted and then comes about in terms of hurricanes, extreme cold, extreme warm weather, what you often get out of the scientists is say, none of us knew that this was going to happen. What they mean is, I didn't know this was going to happen because I do modelling and I don't look at data. But what they say is none of us knew. They try to pull me and other observational scientists into that to say, oh, none of us knew. Well, but in fact, lots of people did know and lots of people predicted it and lots of people warned about it. But then there's another one that has attention's already been drawn to it, how fast sea level rise is going to accelerate. Mm-hmm. And what they do in the report is they take account in the past that the most flagrant failure of IPCC was not to mention the retreat of glaciers at all. Mm-hmm. And simply say sea level rise was due to warming of the ocean. And they produce some outrageously low predictions for where sea level rising would go in the next century, which was terrible because it just was a kind of God's gift to policymakers to be complacent and not spend a lot of money on sea defences. They repented of that in their last assessment, and they included some of the feedbacks due to glacier and ice sheet retreat. And in this one, what they're saying for 1.5 is they're taking account of retreat of Greenland and of the West Antarctic ice sheet, but they're not taking account of anything else. So the things they're not accounting for are the East Antarctic ice sheet, which itself is beginning to retreat, or additional mechanisms happening in Greenland related to the fact that you have this new process of meltwater running down to the bedrock and accelerating the flow of outlet glaciers.
Through the Moulin.
Mm-hmm. Yes, through the Moulins, yeah. That's something that they're not taking account of. And it's a question of these feedbacks, which really you can call self-reinforcing feedbacks. It's where something new happens because of warming. The new thing that happens makes things go worse and worse and worse.
Yes.
And self-reinforcing feedback, which, well, I've drawn attention to a lot of them and other people have drawn attention to them, but IPCC seems to not like self-reinforcing feedbacks because they're things that literally blow up in their faces.
Oh,
and
God.
They don't want anything to blow up in their faces. They want things to perhaps gradually accelerate, but not no surprising things to happen. Because otherwise, I think they feel their call to action will not be heeded if it's too urgent a call. which it seems daft to me. But anyway, that's their attitude.
Now, we've covered two of the three. I thought you had mentioned a third feedback loop.
Oh, yes. The other one that they don't mention is changes in the ocean circulation. For instance, the decline in the thermohaline circulation, it's actually having worldwide implications, but in the Atlantic region, it's reduced flow of warm water up to Europe so that Europe doesn't warm up as fast as it would otherwise do. But also the reduced flow of warm water means that warm water's pooling in the tropical Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, warming up faster than ever, and that's producing a rapid increase in the intensity of hurricanes. Mm. So the intensity of hurricanes is increasing, as we know, each year seems to produce a more destructive hurricane, but that's going to keep happening because of the decline in the thermohaline circulation, even though that lets Western Europe a little bit off the hook as far as warming's concerned. That decline is related, again, to the loss of sea ice, because the sea ice isn't being produced in the Greenland Sea area anymore. That's the region where which drives part of this thermohaline circulation. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of a known fact, and it's been incorporated in people's thinking. But it's not mentioned by IPCC. They don't talk about any changes in global ocean circulation as being important here. So what I think they're saying is, if we can keep, by some means, keep warming below 1.5 degrees, then various other things won't happen, and so we don't have to think about them or mention them. Their reason, I don't think they say it explicitly, but they're saying is, if we find a way to keep the warming down, then other phenomena won't happen, and so we don't have to talk about them. So a methane burst, for instance, won't happen because the sea ice won't retreat. But it's already retreated to the point where you're warming up the coastal seas of the Arctic. It's a mentality of basic complacency when you need a mentality of dire panic warning to say, look, we've got to do things really seriously, desperately.
We need a radical departure.
Yes, I mean, we need one for 2 degrees, because that's not going to be easy to reach or possible, probably. But 1.5, you know, that's really requires something absolutely drastic. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to get it, according to this report. We can smoothly go and continue our lives.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams, interviewed by Stuart Scott on October 11, 2018, on the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Next is Professor Kevin Anderson, interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! They spoke on October 9, 2018.
Florida's preparing for the massive storm as a new report from the United Nations Climate Panel warns humanity has only a dozen years to mitigate climate change or face global catastrophe. The IPCC report lays out several possible pathways to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, including transitions in land use and transportation systems and the adoption of future technologies, including removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. According to the report, global net carbon emissions would need to fall by about 45% from 2010 levels to by 2030 and reach net zero around 2050. Well, for more, we're joined by Kevin Anderson. He is professor of climate change leadership at the Center for Environment and Development Studies at Uppsala University. He's also chair of energy and climate change at Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at the University of Manchester in Britain. Dr. Anderson, welcome back to Democracy Now! I wanted to ask you first about this report as this monster hurricane goes through Latin America and bears down on Florida and Alabama.
The report makes very clear that between 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming and 2 degrees centigrade of warming, we will expect to see more extreme weather conditions, which indeed is why many of the poorer parts of the world asked the scientific community to actually investigate what are the actual differences between impacts at 1.5 and 2 degrees. And of course, 2 degrees was the previous threshold that we were all apparently aiming for. But as has come out from the report, it's very clear that there are a whole suite of impacts that are much worse at 2 degrees centigrade than 1.5, and that these impacts will primarily hit poorer and more climate-vulnerable communities around the world. So it's a very important report in terms of understanding the impacts of climate change and making clear that we must aim really for 1.5 rather than 2 degrees.
You write in your response to this landmark UN report that climate change is ultimately the responsibility of a few high emitters. Explain who they are.
Well, just to put some numbers on this, about half of global emissions arise from the activities of just about 10% of the world's population. And about 70% of all global emissions of carbon dioxide come from about 20% of the world's population. And very closely, the emissions relate to the wealth or the income of the citizens. And so my concern here is that when we try to address climate change and reduce our emissions by focusing on all 7.5 billion people, I think it misunderstands where the actual responsibility for the emissions reside, and therefore we are not developing policies that need to be tailored to that particular 20%. So many people listening to your show now in the US or elsewhere in the world will be medium to low emitters. And to them, yes, it's important they make some changes, but there will also be people listening to this show who are very high emitters. And it is those of us that really the policies need to aim at to drive the emissions out of our lifestyles. And we must make sure in doing that we don't impoverish people who already are struggling with the current economic system.
Who are the highest carbon emitters, Dr. Anderson?
The highest carbon emitters, well, they're going to be the very wealthiest in this world. From a climate point of view, when you hear the Al Gores and the DiCaprios talking about climate change, you look at their carbon footprint, they'll be many thousands of times more than an average African, and many hundreds of times more probably even than many Americans. So it is that sort of, the very wealthy are the very high emitters. But also, I think a professor like myself, senior lecturers in universities, the people who are more what we like to see as senior, the language we use, senior in our organizations, whether that's in companies or in the public or indeed the private sector, these people will be the high emitters. I mean, I won't make any comment on journalists, but certainly some of the journalists I'm familiar with, they are also very high emitters. So it is that upper echelons of society.
And in terms of countries?
The biggest emitter now is China, followed by the US. I mean, both of those countries, of course, there's a big difference between the high emitters within that country and the low emitters within that country. So, the two big emitting countries, though, are the US and China, and then obviously shortly followed by the European Union.
If you look at weather reports, whether we're talking about wildfires in California or these monster storms, there is almost no mention by meteorologists, and I'm not talking even Fox, I'm talking MSNBC and CNN, of the connection between these increasingly violent storms and climate change. Is there one, and can you explain it?
Well, there certainly is a connection. What we have done by putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is we've made the atmosphere warmer. In other words, we've put a lot more energy into the atmosphere. That energy will play out in terms of a whole suite of different, more extreme weather conditions. Now, whether this particular hurricane is caused by climate change is impossible to say. But what is often the case is that we are exacerbating or increasing the power in these hurricanes, in these extreme weather events. What we call the fancy language of attribution, where we're trying to say, is this event a climate change event? We're getting better at understanding that. And certainly there's quite a lot of evidence now to suggest that some of the more recent severe weather conditions we've seen have been seriously exacerbated by the additional warming that we've put into the atmosphere from our burning of fossil fuels and the release of carbon dioxide. And the meteorologists should be making that clear link during the weather forecast within the U.S.
You talk about what's needed, Professor Anderson. The report says there's no documented historic precedent for the scale of changes required. You have talked about a Marshall Plan. What do you mean, a new Marshall Plan?
Well, the Marshall Plan was the deliberate strategy after the Second World War to try and reconstruct Europe after it had been obviously very severely bombed and destroyed, both institutionally but mostly physically during the war. So I'm saying that that is probably the nearest metaphor or analogy we have to the scale of challenge that we actually face to decarbonize, to shift away from a fossil fuel-based energy system to a zero carbon energy system, and to do that within the wealthy parts of the world, really within about two decades, and probably three or three and a half decades for the slightly poorer parts of the world. So we're not going to do that through small price mechanisms, through just tweaking the markets. It is going to require strategic intervention by governments to make the necessary rates of change. Now, that sounds initially sort of very challenging, and certainly it will be, but I think there is also a positive narrative behind this, in that this transition, this transformation to a zero-carbon energy system, will come with lots of job opportunities, long-term secure job opportunities, not just in building low-carbon power stations, but in the massive electrification program that will be necessary, in retrofitting, in other words, making our existing building infrastructure suitable for the 21st century. So you require much less energy to heat it or to cool it, and it is a much safer environment to be in as the climate continues to change, which it undoubtedly will. Even if we stopped emissions today, we'll see some ongoing climate change.
You have criticized the IPCC for constraining its policy advice to fit neatly within the current economic model. Mm. Can you explain?
Well, certainly. Whilst I think it is a really good report in trying to understand the impacts between 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade of warming, when it comes to what we have to do about it, I think, again, it runs scared of really being very honest. And given it's effectively a scientific report, I think our role as scientists and as academics is to tell it like it is, not to colour it or sweeten the pill to make it more attractive. So my comments here are that, and it's not just with this report, it's repeatedly come out of the IPCC. So whilst we're quite direct and honest about the impact side, when it comes to what we have to do about this, we run scared. We don't want to scare the politicians or the public. We don't want to move away from this sort of the energy systems that we have today. So we always try to broadly sort of massage the status quo, so incremental changes, if you like. And what I'm saying is that actually, when you really look at the numbers behind the report, look at the numbers the science comes out with, then we're talking about a complete revolution in our energy system. And that is going to beg very fundamental questions about how we run our economies. And again, you can turn around and say, well, that seems just far too removed from the current economic system we have. But we have to remember it's only been, it's 10 years now since the banking crisis, and many parts of the world are still suffering the repercussions of that banking crisis. So the current economic framework has struggled within its own remit, if you like. But I think this has been a real opportunity, which we are now losing, to reshape that economy so it's an economy that's suitable for society, not a society that's suitable for the economy. And I think the policymakers, sort of the academics, have just run scared of this, of being honest about what our numbers tell us about the rates of change that we require, and how we have to move the productive capacity of our society from building second homes for professors or private jets or private yachts or large four-wheel drive cars, from moving from that to building public transport, electrification, improved homes for everyone. So it's a shift of that productive capacity, the resources and the labour, from the, if you like, the luxury for the 20% to the essential low-carbon infrastructure for all of us.
Dr. Anderson, the effect of Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the frontrunner Jair Bolsonaro has promised that he will pull out of the Paris Agreement as well and would abolish Brazil's Ministry of Environment, which environmentalists fear would lead to deforestation of the Amazon. Your thoughts on both Bolsonaro and Trump?
Clearly, from a scientific perspective, and I would also argue probably from a moral perspective, they are completely out of tune with what our analysis is saying. I also think we have to be very careful when we see these extreme figures, and both of these, I think, are certainly extreme figures. We have to remember that they are a little bit of noise on the system. The general trend line is more recognition that climate change is a serious issue. Even the poll data in the States shows this. I've not seen data for Brazil, so I'm not sure. But so we are seeing climate change events, and people are thinking this is an important issue. Because some of our, perhaps not always the brightest people who are leading our countries, can't understand that or think that they have a political base they have to appeal to who will not want to hear that message, I think the rest of us should not run scared of them. We just have to redouble our efforts. And indeed, when President Trump decided to pull out of the Paris Agreement, which, of course, he can't do yet anyway, but plans to, then the Chinese and the French stepped forward and said, well, we will try and make some extra effort to compensate. And we also see in the U.S. many mayors saying, actually, climate change is still an important issue. So the U.S. is not a dictatorship. Trump cannot dictate what the population of the U.S. is going to do. Of course, he is important and he is influential, but so are the mayors. So it is incumbent on the rest of us who are more informed by the science, and I would argue with a more reasoned, moral and progressive background to our analysis. And it's up to us to redouble our efforts and make sure that we move in the right direction and not to run scared of the chumps of this world. There are plenty of them. They will come and they will go. But the overall issue of climate change, the physics of climate change, is here to stay, regardless of the ephemeral whims of the occasional president.
And in this last minute, what does the future look like? How bad can things get if we proceed on this course?
Well, the way things are going at the moment, I think it is quite reasonable to think we are heading to about 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century. That would be utterly devastating. Just remember, the difference between now and an ice age is about 5 degrees. So we're talking about changes that would normally occur over probably tens of thousands of years, occurring over little more than 100 years. And 100 years, in some respects, sounds like a long time, but many of the people listening to this, their children will still be alive in 100 years, and certainly their grandchildren will be. 100 years is just tomorrow, really, in so many respects. We will be seeing far more famine, drought, floods, changes in food patterns. I think we'll probably start to see lots more tension within communities, and that means then a lot more tension between communities. So as we head towards 4 degrees centigrade of warming, we're talking about breaking down many of the ecosystems of the world. This is a different planet from the one on which we live, and the chaos that will ensue will be bad for our species, for humans, but also, indeed, of course, for many other species around the planet. And that's why we have to do everything we can to hold for 2 degrees centigrade and ideally aim for 1.5. I think that's looking very challenging. So let's do everything we can to keep the temperature as low as possible.
Kevin Anderson, we want to thank you for joining us, the Zennstrom Professor in Climate Change Leadership at the Center for Environment and Development Studies, Uppsala University, also Chair of Energy and Climate Change at Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at the University of Manchester in Britain, where he's speaking to us now.
You heard two critical responses by Professor Kevin Anderson and before him, Professor Peter Wadhams, to the release of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report, IPCC SR 1.5. My thanks go out to Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And to Stuart Scott with the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative for giving them a voice. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
I think we're now joined by Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I am.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us. Before we get to the meat of the matter, do you have a new address for people to read and follow your work?
Yes, I guess they can come to our website, which is crescent.icit-digital.com. www.afghanistan.org.
And that, and that's the website?
That's the website, yes.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you're probably the type of guy that writes Zafar Ben Guy, so get there anyway. So we've, when we hope that people will turn to you. You wrote a book called The Doomed Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And it's looking a little more doomed this afternoon than it was in the last time. And by the way, even then it was shaky. So yes. I guess we'll just have to – and to, just to set this up, tomorrow, Tuesday, there does seem to be a speech expected by the president of Turkey,
yes,
which
yes.
the world will be listening very, very closely.
Yes, he has promised – President Erdogan of Turkey has promised that he is going to reveal the details of what the Turks know about that gruesome murder mm-hmm. in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul that occurred on October the 2nd. As I'm sure most of your listeners would be familiar, that for 15 days, the Saudis kept on denying that Jamal Khashoggi, who of course was a columnist for the Washington Post, they kept on denying that he had been murdered or harmed at the consulate. And in fact, a day after the story broke out that he had been murdered, that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman stated quite categorically that he had been there only for a few minutes or maximum an hour, and then he left the consulate.
Mm.
And of course, there were immediate calls to say, well, if he has left the consulate, then provide us proof. And the Turks, meanwhile, the Turkish government, that is, kept on leaking very, very damaging information mm-hmm. With respect to what had happened. Some of their investigators said that they had collected samples from the sewers connected to the consulate, which obviously indicated that they had collected blood samples because mm-hmm. The journalist was murdered over there.
Mm-hmm.
They had also released information that 15 Saudi operatives had come to Istanbul on two separate flights, private planes from Riyadh that morning, and they had entered the consulate. And among them were certain individuals that are very, very close to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. One of them is actually a forensic expert, a 20-year veteran at the Saudi Interior Ministry. He was the main culprit. His name is Salah Mohammed Al-Tubaygi. He was the one who brought the bone saw. According to the information that the Turks have leaked, that Jamal Khashoggi was actually cut to pieces while he was still alive. And he was this ritual was performed on the consul general's study table, and this man Tubaygi told the other people with him. Among them is an intelligence agent by the name of Mahir Mutrib, who had served in the Saudi embassy in London back in 2007. He's an intelligence agent. There's a personal bodyguard of Mohammed bin Salman as well, who was also part of the entourage of these 15 people. And Tubaygi told these people that when I do this work, when I do this job, I put on my earphones and listen to music. Because obviously they were cutting this man to pieces alive, like they first cut his fingers, then they cut his arms, and then they started to chop him up. And the Turks have said that this it took 7.5 minutes for this man to die. And so they were chopping him up while he was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turks have said, and I mean, of course, the story they put out was that this was all recorded from the Apple Watch that Khashoggi was wearing. I believe that that's a sort of deflection. The real thing is that the Turks definitely had surveillance cameras at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, both audio and video, and they basically captured all of that. The audio they have released to some of the newspapers over there, for instance, Sabah newspaper in Turkey, as well as Yeni Shafak. These are two papers that are close to the government. Both have carried out details, and now we await what Erdogan has to say tomorrow. But I also want to add that gruesome as this murder is, it seems to me that both the Americans as well as the Turks, Erdogan in particular, they are playing this game. They want to basically portrayed Khashoggi's murder for some financial benefits. So the Americans have their own plan, the Turks have their own plan, and let's see, we'll see whether Erdogan is going to reveal any information or any significant information tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Because what I suspect is that perhaps, I mean, he could have done that yesterday, for instance, but he said, I'm going to do it on October the 23rd. Mm-hmm. Now, I suspect that this was a message to the Saudis that whatever he is demanding, if they don't comply with, then he's going to begin to reveal or release more information.
He has a draft of two or three speeches.
Exactly.
Would you like speech number one?
Speech number two? It'll cost you so much if the speech number two will be this much, et cetera. So,
yeah.
and from what I have read and heard, that the Saudis offered him $1 billion, then other figures that were mentioned was $5 billion, but obviously he's aiming for much more. We need to keep in mind that when the Turks, when the Americans basically embargoed Turkey and the lira, the Turkish lira went into a tailspin, mm-hmm. that the Saudis were also part of that plot. They pulled out billions of dollars that they had invested in Turkey.
Whoa.
And this money was actually invested back in May of 2011, and that was the bribe that was offered to the Turks by the Saudis to get them to do two things. Number one, to join the war on Libya and therefore destroy Gaddafi's government, and number two, to join the war on Syria, which, of course, in which they have failed. But these were the two things that were demanded of Turkey. And that was the $10 billion that the Saudis invested in Turkey. So when when the Americans put sanctions on Turkey, the Saudis also pulled their money out of Turkey. So it precipitated a financial crisis inside Turkey. And now Erdogan is coming back and saying, okay, now we have you by the throat, and so now you either cough up or we are going to give up, release this other information. Mm-hmm. So let's see what happens tomorrow. I'm looking forward to it.
Everybody's, it's like a championship game.
Absolutely.
Because he's going to reset the agenda for everybody. The debates are going to go in a dozen directions.
Yes.
Mr. Erdogan has been himself a very unstable figure. Every time we interview you, actually, he's on a different tack.
Exactly.
And so, and I want to ask about this. Some months back, Trump invested heavily, and I shouldn't say Trump. The U.S. administration has been warm towards the Saudis. They were selling the Saudis as reformers and as the leading state in the region. And its job as a leading state was to remove the government in Damascus, and then more importantly, to get rid of the government of Iran, which the U.S., by the way, is accelerating that process. They're stepping it up. They are openly embracing the terrorist group from Iran that used to be harbored by Saddam Hussein, and all of their leaders speak to that group and embrace them publicly. But this is a shambles, is it not, for this whole for that game?
Yes, of course. What has happened is that Trump also is playing a very devious role over here. On the one hand, he's trying to protect Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, by saying, well, like, it was he who suggested that this probably was an operation carried out by rogue killers. These are his crosswords.
Yes.
And, of course, the Saudis then, you know, 2 days ago, that's the story they put out, that the crown prince did not know about this, he was not aware of this. And yet yesterday, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Shafak came up with a story, and they said that before Khashoggi was killed, he had been made to speak to the crown prince on this guy's cell phone, mm-hmm. this guy Maher Mutrib, who incidentally has now been put in prison, and most likely he will be killed because he obviously
if he's lucky.
Exactly. There are going to be a few people that definitely the Saudis would like to get rid of immediately, because they know all the things and they get rid of them, then obviously there is nobody, as they say, dead men don't speak. And mm-hmm. so that story, you know, their information would be buried with them. Now, mm-hmm. Yeni Shafak said that the Crown Prince spoke to Khashoggi, and in fact the conversation that went was that the Crown Prince told him to come back to Saudi Arabia, and Khashoggi declined because he feared that if he went back, he would not only be arrested, but he would be killed. Mm-hmm. And I think he was right in that, but I mean, he didn't realize that if he refused to go, he'd be killed right there and he'd be chopped up alive.
Well, by the way, he probably made a miscalculation in terms of his... He was friendly to the Turkish government. He must have assumed that he'd be fairly safe there because he'd also gotten himself an apartment there, right?
Yes, exactly.
Very foolish.
Yes. Well, that's the big mistake that he made. I think there are a number of people that set him up, including the Saudi ambassador in Washington, who is the younger brother of the crown prince, the Saudi ambassador Khalid bin Salman, because Khashoggi first went there to obtain his documents, divorce documents or papers from there, and he was told that they can't get him anything. He has to go to Istanbul because his fiancée is Turkish, and he has to mm-hmm. get the documents there. So when he approached the Saudi mm-hmm. consulate in Istanbul, he was told that they can't do anything, but they will pass this information on to the intelligence agency. And, of course, the intelligence agency called him, and they said they can arrange for it. It'll take about a week. So that was the fateful
Make sure
day.
You're there at 11.
Exactly. Absolutely. So he walked into his death den on October the 11th at 1:41.
Well, let's set the context a bit, you know, because, of course, it is a hideous story. But I've been looking at material that reminding us that Mr. Khashoggi, he's called a journalist now, and he spent 1 year at the Washington Post. Many Saudis, by the way, must have asked, how come he got that job if he was criticizing the reform leader of Saudi Arabia?
Exactly.
I have right in front of me, in the Washington Post, he wrote an article, and the title was, It's Time to Divide Syria.
Yes.
And that's July 3, 2018. He also said when Trump fired the missiles at Syria, he said, we are all with Donald Trump now.
Yes.
And about the al-Qaeda people using beheading as a technique, he said that was a smart tactic.
Yeah.
And his name, I remember a famous arms dealer involved with Iran and Reagan and the Contra business in Nicaragua. His name was Adnan Khashoggi. Are they related?
That was his father.
That's his father.
So it's a small world.
Yeah, he's a journalist, right?
Well, you're right.
So he might know a little something about hardball.
Yes, exactly. See, this guy, Jamal Khashoggi, has been an apologist for the Saudi regime for decades. He served with the former Saudi intelligence chief, Turki Al-Faisal, who was the intelligence chief for 23 years. And then he was ambassador in London and then in Washington, D.C. And wherever Turki Al-Faisal went, Jamal Khashoggi went with him. And Jamal Khashoggi also headed Al-Hayat newspaper. And more recently, he was sort of, you know, head of a TV program, etc. So he has been an insider throughout. Now, you mentioned as to how come he got this job at the Washington Post. That's a very, very important point to note. Washington Post, obviously, I think, you know, your listeners should know, has very deep CIA connections. Mm-hmm. So it was basically CIA that allowed him that space so that they could now use him. And there, essentially, there is one theory that is floating around, and that is that they basically, the CIA and Soros and others wanted to start a color revolution. Now, Jamal Khashoggi was going around the Middle East meeting important figures, and he was going to set up a group called Democracy for the Arab World Now, with mm-hmm. an abbreviation DAWN, D-A-W-N. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people had also paid him money to set up something like this, and his role was that he will collect these intellectuals, etc. Incidentally, a day or so before he went to the consulate on October the 2nd. He had had dinner with Azam Tamimi. Now, Azam Tamimi is a Palestinian exile living in London, but he's also part of this network. So mm-hmm. It seems to me that he was basically, Jamal Khashoggi's task assigned to him by the CIA was to set up this thing to bring about a color revolution in Saudi Arabia and to put somebody in power, possibly the former crown prince, Mohammed bin Naif, who had been unceremoniously dismissed, who had very close CIA connections. Mm-hmm. And so they probably wanted to bring Mohammed bin Naif back into power because the CIA felt more comfortable with him because he was just as ruthless, but much more.
By the way, they can't.
Smart.
They just have itchy fingers, don't they? I mean, these intelligence guys, because you and I spoke earlier about this, and throughout history it's been noted. The U.S. and the British have a kind of warehousing for people who could be the leaders of various countries.
Exactly.
And they live in and around, CIA headquarters in Virginia.
Yes.
Foggy Bottom, or whatever it's called. And then the British have this as well, where there are princes and would-be monarchs. And at any moment, they can say to a head of state, you know, we're not too happy with you, and we do have Prince so-and-so living right down the road here.
Yes.
In the case of President Edoyan, he wants to know why the U.S. harbors a man named Gulen. Is that his name?
That's correct.
Who has
Gulen, yes.
Who was the figure behind the, it appeared to be a coup, an
yes.
attempted coup.
Yes.
And you know, while they are used and the border is open for terrorists to enter Syria from Turkey, and while Saudi Arabia finances people who go into Syria and create mayhem, at the same time, they have to kind of watch their backs because the U.S. seems to be having like a backup quarterback, they would say, in football.
Yes, yes. Now, you see, as we speak right now, the U.S. is supporting and protecting these ISIS terrorists in Syria, and they, in fact, threatened even Russia that if ISIS positions are attacked, that there is going to be consequences, and that there are risks of Russia getting involved directly with America. So mm-hmm. the Russians have unfortunately backed down from that, and so they have stopped their bombing raids of ISIS positions in Syria. Earlier on, you mentioned this group, Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, MKO terrorists. They are a well-known terrorist organization. They were on the State Department list until 2012. Mm-hmm. And then under lobbying from various Congress members as well as mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, etc., mm-hmm. this group was removed from that terrorist list.
Unleashed.
Although they still continue to indulge in terrorist acts. Mm-hmm. And, as you mentioned, top officials, Rudy Giuliani, John Bolton, all of these people are yes. regular,
Bolton,
yeah, exactly. They are regularly appearing on their conference.
And they are paid big bucks. So it's a deeply corrupt business as well.
Absolutely.
Everybody gets a little something,
exactly.
A little add-on, a little lanyard, as they say yes. in New Orleans.
Yes, and Turki Al-Faisal is also a regular fixture on those on their conferences. So we see that all of these shady characters, this criminal enterprise. Mm-hmm. is involved in backing these terrorists because they want to target Iran. And let mm-hmm. me say this, that this organization, MKO, has absolutely zero support inside Iran. And so the best way to not go about overthrowing the government of Iran is to back these people. Mm-hmm. In fact, if anybody in Iran hears this name, because these people have perpetrated such horrible crimes in Iran, they've murdered more than 12,000 people, including top leaders, the prime minister, the president, mm-hmm. Chief Justice, members of parliament, leading yes. scholars, etc. The list is endless.
Yes.
That the people of Iran hate the MKO terrorists. And now mm-hmm. they have, of course, realized even more that if the CIA is behind them, if the Americans are behind them, obviously these people are up to no good.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot be good. They just simply would not have them. And mm-hmm. so, I don't know whosoever is whatever their thinking is, But
they call it thinking. Mad conspiracies would. By the way, everybody gets a living out of this, right? I mean, it's for Bolton. The bucks get bigger and bigger. The dumber he becomes.
Exactly.
They say, "Is there anybody dumb enough to say this?" They said, "Bolton will say it." Okay, we pay him $1 million. About the instability in the region and all of this, the great run-up to destroy President Assad and the government of Syria, it all seems to be breaking into pieces. I noticed that the Arab League now is talking about asking Syria to rejoin. When they ran them out of the Arab League, now they're talking about bringing them back. And then today, the King of Jordan suddenly announces that he doesn't want to lease property to Israel anymore.
Yes.
So everybody must be very scared.
Of course they are, because this whole situation relating to Jamal Khashoggi, etc., is blowing up in their face. It's not working out the way they had thought. And so everybody is trying to protect their backside. And as you said, you know, the Arab League is now thinking about inviting Syria back. You know, during the UN session last month, the Arab League Secretary General actually met the Syrian Foreign Minister at the UN, and they had a pleasant conversation. And so did the Bahraini Foreign Minister. Now, this is the first time that the Bahrainis, who are part of the Saudi camp and this part of the conspiracy group trying to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad, that they are now reaching out to the Syrian government because they have realized that they burnt their fingers in Syria, that they are not going to be able to succeed. And so the best thing is to cut their losses and try to make up now.
But by the way, now that raises, I had heard the same rumors about MBS that they said he didn't veto. Apparently, Saudi Arabia had veto on a lot of this, but they stopped vetoing people. But that brings us to another outfit. I shouldn't call them this. Qatar.
Yes.
Now, is Qatar still the homeland of the hard line? Are they going to – they still – let's get Iran? I should back up. The Saudis accuse them of being nice to Iran. Maybe it's only the Saudis left. What is Qatar's position on all these things?
Well, Qatar has actually remained absolutely silent about this. They have not said anything, although their station Al Jazeera has been releasing leaks off and on regarding the Khashoggi story. There was a meeting in New York arranged by Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, and he had gathered all of these Arab foreign ministers, including Qatar, because basically Qatar had been ostracized by Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, and Egypt, of course. And Pompeo got them together to see if they could, you know, patch up things, but it didn't work out. And of course, there was this other plan that they're going to make an Arab NATO army. And they're going to meet again in January.
Yes.
But I think that's all now down the drain because of these recent developments. So that wouldn't fly anywhere.
Yeah. So they probably ought to stop posing for ghoulish photographs. All of them holding the world and lighting the room up with their faces. Zafar Benghazi, the book is The Doomed Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
The House of Saud.
The House
of Saud.
The House. Well, tomorrow, Erdogan will give a speech and maybe blow the windows out of the house, I guess.
Well, let's see what happens. I'm now really very tempted to write another one to catch up with all these latest developments, but they're moving so fast that I can't keep up with them.
I think you will have to write a new one because, you know, here's the deal. Once you predict something and it happens, you also have to write after that. You can't retire.
You know, you'll recall some years ago when we had talked, this was in 2016, and I had said that there is a good possibility that a coup attempt may be made in Turkey, and within 2 weeks there was a coup attempt.
Yeah. No, you have those powers. We're very appreciative. Zafar Benghazi, Crescent International, thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you, Phil.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.